Blog Talk Radio.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. الرحمن الرحيم. مالك يوم الدين. إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين. اهدنا الصراط المستقيم. صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Latifa A. Hameen, the CEO for American Muslim 360, the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice is protected.
The views expressed by the host guests are their own and not necessarily the position of AM360 or the parent corporation, the Community-Wide Shura Conference, CWSC Incorporated. AM360 content is intended as a community service and is not designed to provide specific personal, medical, financial, or legal counsel or other professional advice, and no liability shall extend to the host or hostesses of AM360 or CWSC. We encourage you to seek an advisor for your specific circumstance. Now Joshua fought the battle of Jericho,
and the walls came tumbling down. Community-Wide Shura Conference and American Muslim 360 invites you to promote your organization or event on the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice protected. Affordable rates allow you to promote your event, product, or service and strengthen our national intelligentsia network. Contact corporate underwriting today at info@cwsc.us. That's info@cwsc.us. Or call 910-317-0297. Again, 910-317-0297. Together we can remake the world.
Good afternoon, dear listeners. Assalamu alaikum. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah wa ashhadu anna Muhammadan wa ashhadu anna Muhammadan abduhu wa rasuluhu. We are now in the United Ta'aleem, CWSC and SCMA, United Ta'aleem. Welcome, and we're going to connect now with SCMA.
To hear you well, and we do have a few people on already, plus AM360 is connected.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, we're here.
Let me, we'll open up with dua. I do have one brief announcement before we start today's topic, and then we'll turn the floor over to yourself and Imam Hamid. So let's begin with Al-Fatiha. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين
آمين.
Welcome everyone to FNA or Florida's Conference of Muslim Americans. First Sunday, United Tallinn Hall. Today we have our distinguished guest of Imam Delaysi Umar, as well as Imam Mikhail Hamid. And I guess we have another guest, potentially Mustafa Ibn Abdul.
Mustafa helped me organize this PowerPoint. He's a 15-year-old Muslim brother here in Melbourne.
Okay, alhamdulillah.
He's helping me on this end if need be.
Very well. So today we have a nice conversation about zakat as an Islamic economic system. But before we turn the floor over to Imam Delaysi, just wanted to kind of just a quick announcement is that, as you all know, that next week, October, will be the 2023 Community Development and Leadership Conference. This is actually put on by the National Sustainers and hosted by SMA and Master Potter. So the agenda is briefly flashed on the screen for those who are online on the call. The program will start with registration on Friday before Jumu'ah. And then after Jumu'ah, there's registration. And then starting at 3 o'clock, there's a panel plenary session, which the part of it is go over the premise and the basics for the conference for the next couple of days, a breakfast alive, and then a presentation on a community survey. Part of leading into the conference, we actually want to take a survey, roughly a few questions that kind of help get a pulse of all the respective communities around the nation. So if you had a chance, please go do that. And the plan is to present the results from the survey Friday evening. And then you have a series of workshops starting Saturday morning at 8:30, and that will continue all the way through the evening with a dinner, presentation, and entertainment starting at 5. Sunday begins at 8:30 again, and the day promptly concludes around 12 noon, inshallah. You can go to the website. I am MMWD, so imwdcommunity.com. I'm sorry. It's iwdmcommunity.com is the website to register, as well as get more conference detail, as well as to complete the link. So on that note, that's the brief announcement I wanted to share. I do want to turn the floor over to Imam Delaysi.
Are you sharing your screen, Brother Wali?
I am.
Okay, very good. And with God's name, the merciful.
I just want to double check the email address. For clarity, again, to registering your details about the conference, it is iwdmcommunity.com. iwdmcommunity.com is the link. And so that's what makes sure I give you the proper information. And we'll repeat this at the end of the call.
Yeah.
On that note, I will turn the floor over to Imam Delaysi. Just tell me when you want to advance the slide.
All right, I will. God's name, the merciful benefactor, the merciful redeemer. Dear believers, peace and blessings to you all, listeners who are on AM 360, as well as our Muslim present on Zoom link, and every believers here in Florida, as well as visiting guests. Welcome to our third Sunday Tallinn. One of the interests that Imam Muhammad, may Allah be pleased, with him in paradise, He presented a topic, zakat, the Islamic economic system. And, you know, we started doing some work on the topic on AM 360 on the broadcast, preparing to make it in the land of plenty. Comes on Saturday, 9:30 till 11 a.m., every Saturday morning, where we deal with different topics from an and show how the religion of Islam can be utilized to apply. And so we started to explore and experiment with how to present Zakat as an Islamic economic system. So we did a brief PowerPoint here with the help of Mustafa Abdul Ibn Kabir, Ibn Abdul Kabir, young man, 15, had him assisting me with this PowerPoint. And thank you, Brother Wali, for cleaning it up a little bit for us as well and making it a little shorter. Thanks for that. So we want to just take a quick look, and then we're going to some things that we outlined that we thought would be important for Islamic economic system with an eye to model community development. So I wanted to share this with Sister Nala as well for her 50-year human family planning initiative. So this would be, I think, a talking point where we can move and do research and benefit from it. So, Michael, please come in and start the presentation, if you would, and make some comments. We got about 40 minutes to do comments. We want to reserve some time for questions and answers and comments from the listeners.
Yes, sir. As-salamu alaykum to all. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This presentation is Zakat, Islamic Economic System. And the first slide, the next slide will be I don't have access to changing.
Wally, can you move that to the next slide?
Yeah, okay. So we have the idea of sadaqah and zakat. Zakat is an obligation on all Muslims, obligatory almsgiving or charity. And sadaqah is a voluntary giving to support our position as being Muslim followers of Prophet Muhammad and followers of the Quran. So zakat, in the word, it has to do with purity or purification. And this is what we are moving the focus from: the individual purifying their resources, their material resources, giving a portion of those resources to the Zakat fund. So expanding upon that, we're looking at a system of economy that will do likewise, purify our what we call free enterprise accumulation of resources, accumulation of wealth, seeing a system that will not give itself to the ills and the problematic issues of capitalism. So we won't go into, those problematic concerns, but many of us know about them, and we can also easily go to Google. We can Google them. So next slide will give us the category of eligible recipients, of this individual giving of zakat. Imam, did you want to go over those?
Yeah, let's just briefly do that, and so we'll be clear on what they are. I think it's important. Yes, but we'll do it briefly. We won't elaborate very much. Just go over those, Michael, please.
So we have the poor. And we asked the audience if you'll please mute your phone so we can have a good a good recording and reception. The poor is al fuqara. These are individuals who are without means. They're destitute, insufficient means to meet their basic needs, and they may require financial help to help them with their living expenses. That's one. The needy, al masakin. This category includes people who are not as poor, but they still need assistance to meet their basic needs, such as food, clothing, and shelter. Say again.
I said we had others.
Yes, sir. Go ahead. Okay, number three, those administering the zakat, the administrators of the funds, al-amidin, alayha. This category includes individuals or organizations responsible for collecting, managing, and distribution of the funds. Number four, new converts to al-Islam. Al-Mu'alafatu, Kulubuhum. This category consists of individuals who have recently embraced al-Islam and may face difficulties due to their conversion. Zakat funds can be used to support and strengthen their faith. Number five, captives or those who are enslaved. Rakab. In contemporary times, today's times, this category typically refers to individuals who are unlawfully detained or enslaved. Zakat can be used to help secure their freedom or improve their condition. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Okay, I see you, yes. Those who are in debt, Al-Gharimin, individuals who are in debt and struggling to repay their loans can receive zakat assistance.
Michael, let me elaborate on these two, the slaves and the debt, you know, because we have been doing some collection of information and on our program of how al-Islam addressed slavery, we talked about how the religion itself in its directive has actually where Almighty Allah has addressed freeing the slaves. And I think we have the only religion that goes directly to the point. You know, the Imam shared with us that al-Islam, the Quran, freed the slaves without a shot being fired. And, you know, and many, many aspects of slavery is addressed in the Quran, and the Prophet, peace be upon him, has addressed it. So this is another important factor that we want to highlight. And also the debt, the person in debt, because debt is also a form of slavery. As you can see, they're together, and we know in this society there has been an effort to keep people in debt for usury, interest, et cetera, et cetera. So just wanted to make those comments and make the connection between these two items that the Quran came with revelation to require us as individuals to spend our resources on relieving the suffering of people who are under these conditions. Go ahead, Michael, continue, please.
Now, these conditions are such that are given to us from the history of the Muslim community under the leadership of Prophet Muhammad. Those in the way of Allah, those who individuals or groups that are engaged in activities, travelers who are stranded or facing financial hardship while on a journey, and lastly, the wayfarers. This category includes individuals who are unable to return to their place of residence. Now, this may be a bit elaborate, we don't have a Beit Elnaam. We don't have a treasury at this time to deal with these issues, or a mechanism by way money just doesn't sit there until someone approaches with the need. Next category, please. Okay, the traditional economies dealing with supply and demand.
Let me make some comments on that, Michael, if you would.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, when you look up economic systems, they have capitalism, socialism, and what's the other one? Capitalism, socialism, and communism. So, and traditional economies are varied in their aspects, where they respect certain tribal customs, religious customs, et cetera, et cetera. So when we are talking about developing the care, we would be going into uncharted territory, so to speak, where we are going to be addressing it from a contemporary picture of how we can function as a community here in America in terms of building model communities, supporting the building of model communities. Just wanted to share those concepts. Yes. Go ahead, Mike.
Okay. Yes. So when you look up economic system, and we mentioned here in the West, in America, market system, but economic systems are the way by which communities and governments distribute resources and trade goods and services. They are used to control the five factors of production, including labor, capital, entrepreneurs, physical resources, and in information resources. In everyday terms, these production factors involve the employees and the money a company has at its disposal, as well as access to entrepreneurs, the people who want to run companies or start their own business. The physical material and resources needed to run a business, along with the information and knowledge companies use to be successful. And so this is the environment in which we are putting the overlay of a system that is aware in its philosophy as well as in its structure that we are being commanded by Almighty God to purify our material resources. So it's the purification of the above, the economic system, purifying it so that we can get the best results in favor of Almighty God. Next slide, please. Okay, we have categories of wealth that are subject to zakat. And, further in this structure of categories, is the length of time that the resources are held by the particular individual or groups. So you have agricultural produce, livestock, absolute ownership gives unequivocal right of ownership to the owner and cannot be disputed or challenged by anyone, abundance. Business wealth, those in debt, treasure, gold or silver resources, and zakat donations or zakat on agriculture. It's the recognizing recognition that a portion of the system acknowledges a social responsibility And we have individuals that are doing such in their community, like Dr. Muhammad Yunus. There are a number of books where he introduces resources to needy individuals to put them in business, and so that they will become productive members and they will have the resources to give zakat.
Yes, that, and death, I think, was in there by accident.
Yes.
Oh, okay. That's a nice question. Okay.
Yeah, that is in there. That shouldn't be in that category.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Michael. Next slide.
Next slide. Okay, we have institutions/committees for zakat administration. Establishing the Zakat Research Committee. We need those who have the interest and the tools, the background to research Zakat in terms of the needs of our institutional life. Things to be researched such as the collection. All of this is very straightforward. The calculation and verification, the management. These things are mentioned in the, except for the Zakat research, these things are mentioned in the history of the community of Al-Islam under the Prophet Muhammad's leadership in the city of Medina al-Munawwara. It's pretty straightforward, handling special education and outreach. A educating of ourselves by individuals that have that interest in the economy and a healthy, productive economic institution. And so these institutional committees are for administration. Next slide. Institutions needed for an Islamic economic system. I think we pretty much went over that.
I think this is a different one, Michael. This is institutions. These are not committees. This is institutions. These will be physical structures.
Yes, so we have educational institutions, Islamic finance training center, Islamic banks and credit unions.
Let me just pause right here. By the way, Graceline Incorporated has requested that we go to their website. I guess it's gracelineinc.com and fill out the field of membership forms. They are in the process of still trying to get potential credit union members. There's no cost to do it. Just fill out the form on their website, GracelineIncorporated.com, and inshallah we could be making a contribution to hurry on that process, because they are very close now to waiting on the Federal Credit Union to certify their applications. All the information is put in now, except the still a membership they're working on. And just wanted to announce that. So that would be our bank and credit union that we can put our funds in to help facilitate model community development. Go ahead, Mike, please.
Yes, so these institutions that are needed for the economic system are those by which, and this requires again, educational institutions to teach us. You know, our public has to come into the knowledge of how to form, what do you call it, informed consent in terms of how we involve ourselves. And it's a growing process. We've got WAC. Endowments and trusts, foundations. Now, this is maybe new to us everyday men and women, but we have the established economic resources come about from people with money leaving endowments or trusts or foundations.
Yeah.
So,
Michael, let me intervene and ask Brother Wally some, because this is something we've been working on in FCMA as well. Brother Wally, would you like to make a comment on that?
Sure. I want to say maybe a few years ago, there was a request by Mem DeLeso and a few other people establishing exactly what this is, a Walkwell Foundation of Trust. And so we propose a few models of consideration. One of them is centered around the notion that around the country, there are these community foundations, and community foundations, they exist to collect and pool resources that that can be tax deductible from their contributor, invest it for the benefit of the greater good, and then redistribute it back to qualified nonprofits. And I've used that term deliberately for a reason. As long as the funds are distributed back to a qualified nonprofit, and that's basically someone's 501c3, et cetera, then the whole process, right, stays tax deductible. And then as such, it allows you to advance the mission that Imam DeLeso and Imam Michael are explaining.
Yeah.
Okay. So we did propose a structure that could be considered to really move forward this plan. And in fact, many of the points that are on the screen here were part of that conversation.
Yes. And, you know, and trust also is another thing we are working on. Brother Rashad from in Tallahassee, Man Rashad, is looking at how to secure our properties in a trust format so that it can be preserved for the use they were intended. So,
yeah.
Alhamdulillah. So, Michael, go ahead on, and we'll get through this, and inshallah, we have some questions and comments right after this.
Yeah, I'm thinking the need to educate ourselves as members of the Association of Imam Muhammad to where leaving endowments, establishing of foundations where monies are collected such a way as to finance other areas. Imam Muhammad told us that we need to have our businessmen and women make the Quran their business partner. And in such, these individuals will see a greater fresh perception in terms of how important businessmen and women are to the progress, community life, and community institutions. It's very important, and it's very important that the everyday common men and women and our role in terms of this process, you know, our public has to be educated. We need to be an educated public in terms of how other communities are utilizing these principles to have a better, a healthier, and a more productive future here in the land of plenty. Next slide, please.
That may be your last slide. Let me just double check something.
Say again, please.
Yeah,
I think that was your last slide.
Yeah, we had a few more things there that I thought was good, but they are not needed in this presentation. And this, by the way, this was just to give us a perspective on where and how we could move ahead with some of these, with this idea of zakat that was introduced to us by Imam Muhammad. And in the language, it's the Islamic economic system, you know, and alhamdulillah, we appreciate everyone attending, and we hope that we can keep building on this concept and keep it in mind, because these things our Imam presented for us, they had very, very powerful significance as we are looking at model community development. And the banking system that's on the way, that credit union, is going to be a very important stabilizing factor where we can put monies probably in different funding situations that can be administered by the credit union, and everyone would feel more comfortable with their money in a safe, supposedly safe environment. You know, this society is very, very troubled at times. So economics is always a floating situation. So thank you all, and inshallah, Michael, you have any final comments you'd like to share? And then we'll go to questions and answers.
Yes, sir. What we're looking at is a process of Imam Wahdi Muhammad maturing in terms of our social obligation. You know, Almighty God, Allah tells us in the Quran that our own selves obligate us. And Allah has structured his guidance in a way for us to mature. You know, we go from compulsive behavior that is focused on self. Please mute your phone. Nefsin al-Amara, which is the compelling self, the self that is pretty much focused on the individual and its needs. And then we mature to the next level where we are reflective in terms of our behavior. Nefsin al-Amara is the critiquing. You know, we look into ourselves and see how we can be better, how we can be more mature, how we can accept more responsibility, our choice making, you know, being more responsibility for our individual and group situation. And lastly, we come to the point of Nefsin Mutmaina, where we're mature to a point where we're pleased with the development that Allah has helped us with our individual self, as well as the collective self. And we're pleased with that development, and God is pleased with us.
Alhamdulillah. So we got a few minutes for questions and answers, Wally. If you would take charge of that, we'd be very happy.
Yes, sir. Okay. If you're on the Zoom call and you want to raise a question, feel free to raise your hand. If you're on the call with AM360, please identify yourself through those channels. And Sister Nyla, if there's any questions there, just let us know.
Yes, we have a hand raised here on AM360. Let me open
there. Okay, go for it.
704-598. Assalamu alaikum. Your mic is open. 704-598. You have any questions for Imam Delese Uma and Michael Hameen presenting on Zakat?
Hey, are they on mute, Sister Nyla?
I don't know. 704-598. Apparently, their hand probably was raised by background noise. That will activate that number one. Okay, we're going to go out. Everyone else is listening. If you have a question, please press one. Everyone, okay, no one else. Back to you.
So any comments as well? We want to welcome comments. Brother Wally, you have any comments you'd like to share with us?
I do. Let me go back to your presentation. I want to highlight something that you guys mentioned. Okay, the screen is loading. Okay, so the team mentioned, so they mentioned the requirements, and they talked about the who can receive and the reasons why. And then they mentioned the types of wealth, right, that is subject to the cap, right, calculation.
Yes.
And then they mentioned this section here about the need for the, to call it an infrastructure, on how to make sure that we're all aware of all obligations, how to properly do the calculation. And then this is more on the administration side of things, right?
Right.
And then there's this reference to a Zakat fund management. This piece, this bullet here, ties into the next slide that gets into the whole infrastructure that could be put in place, or maybe already in place already. You mentioned the Grace Bonds Credit Union, because you're going to need a place to put the funds that you're collecting.
That's right.
Place to invest those that you're collecting, so they're not just sitting and being stuffed in the proverbial mattress, right? You want them to grow and grow halal, so they can actually benefit the long term, right? These are all long term investments, so it only makes sense if you make smart long term investments along those ways. Then you have the need for businesses to be a way of facilitating that. Like, for instance, you can theoretically, not on the example I mentioned about the foundation, but if it is possible to use the CAT or that kind of fund to help establish halal businesses. Think of our needs for halal food, for halal feed, for halal shopping, clothing, et cetera. You go down the line, right? You have a way of funding our own needs, either through the banks, the credit unions, through their ability to provide, you know, financial instruments or service to businesses who turn off a lot of back with services that we need for our everyday activities. And I'm not talking about the one. This is simply on what we need for food, shelter, and protection, right? The basics, right?
Yes.
But this model that they mentioned is laying a foundation for that. And you can see it playing out. You can see how it played out. Right, and the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him, when they had the whole scenario of establishing community in Medina and establishing the core infrastructure, you know, with the businesses being the drive, and then the fee and community identifying the need to collect and then distribute. Collect, identify, and distribute, right? That's the economic system in a nutshell that we heard today. And hopefully it's enough to motivate ourselves, including myself, to continue to push for this need. It is a vital need of our community. If we're always dependent on others, then we're at the mercy of others to meet our own needs.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Wally, for that. For certain. And that's what this was intended, to just stimulate our thinking on provide some background in terms of foundation of what how to look at it in terms of long-term perspectives.
Yes, sir.
So thank you again, everyone, for allowing us to present. Inshallah.
That's right.
You know, and I really think this is a historic event for us to look at how to take this community forward with Zakat as an Islamic economic system. Thank you.
And I think there's a comment or question.
Yes, please.
Yes, Assalamu alaikum. Imam Akil Muhammad Akil here. Alhamdulillah. Greetings to everyone. We want to thank dear brother Imam DeLacy, Umar, and brother Michael Hameen for and our hardworking convener, brother Wali, for contributing to putting together this excellent, thoughtful, well-considered and researched presentation about an aspect of our Islamic life that we know is vital, is critical to our growth and maturation and future existence as a strong, Quranic-based community of Muslims and believers. Imam Muhammad guided us to, in whatever we seek to do, not be guided by our emotions or and our passions or our self-interest, even though they might be on course, on track, but to not be guided by that and to make sure that what we're doing is consistent with Quranic logic, with the Sunnah and the Sirah of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, are consistent with Imam Muhammad's tafsir, and including the tafsir of Quran bil Quran, and consistent with the context. You know, we're not in Saudi Arabia. You know, we're not in Iran or Iraq, or you know, we're in America. So it likewise has to be consistent with the context. Historical, geographical, political, et cetera, in which we live. During the time that we were privileged to serve as Southern Region Convener, now called subsections. Now they call it sections. They were called regions. But one of the things that we worked very hard to do with the assistance of brothers like Imam Salim Al-Amin, who's an active member, several late brothers who have departed, no longer with us, Imam Ibrahim Bacha, Imam Fahim Ali, Imam Muhammad Harifuddin, et cetera, was to set standards. Some of us will recall that Imam Muhammad, for an example, said, if somebody in your area gets a building or run-down, dilapidated building, and puts a sign up on that building and says, Imam W.D. Muhammad High School or Sister Clara Muhammad Elementary School, say, if you don't have strong believers in your area, people who have the faith and the courage and the strength to go up and correct it, he said, I will come down myself and tear the sign off that building, right? And so we have to set standards, and what has been presented today reflects the excellence toward which we all should be striving. So we ask Allah to find favor on the work of these hardworking brothers, to find favor on what they have presented to us, so that it grows, help us to grow in our maturation and in our development, so that, as they said, so that Allah will be pleased with us, and we'll be well pleased with Allah as our Lord, and so that we'll be well pleased with Imam Muhammad as our teacher, not leader. He says the Prophet Muhammad, prayers and peace be upon him, is our leader. And just one final thing. And just one final quick comment. Perhaps we have it already. If not, we ought to be part of the consideration. Within the state of Florida, for an example, is there a roster of Islamic centers and masajid that are part of the Association of Imam W.D. Muhammad? Is there such a roster? Is there, in fact, a confirmed list of imams and other leaders, business people, et cetera, that are part of our community and our association? Why do I mention that? Because after we open up the doors and let anyone come in, and then that was a problem. Imam Muhammad knew what he was doing. But many of our centers of masajid have boards, for an example, where you have on those boards Muslims who are from other areas, perhaps other ways of thinking, and they may or may not identify with our association. There's no school of thought, et cetera, but they may, in their own orientation and history, be aligned with the school of thought. And so as we move forward, it seems to me that it would be helpful to have some clear understanding, including a roster, to know what centers, masajid, what imams, what areas are, in fact, a part of our association. I think the dues, paying of dues, helps to clarify that to some extent. But is there anything else that we need to do to clarify that as we go forward, so we have a good sense of what our potential strength is, as we continue to move forward in this development? Thank you for listening. Thanks again, brother, for your hard work and scholarly and excellent work in that presentation. That's not what I could say.
So now let's get just to answer your question real quick. So there's a roster that was being compiled by Imam Yassin Bashir out of Catholic, and in fact, he was using that same exercise to conduct a survey, to even to go one step further to better understand the size of those different communities that made up that roster. So we do have some context information related to that. So the second part of your statement regarding the governance, if you will, of the masalas in this community, that's kind of where we historically may have stopped. And you know the history of why that is the case, so we won't get into that on the call. But we do have a starting point for that. And this is another question. That's probably a good segue into next week's conference, because if I'm not mistaken, the focus of it being around community development, that is a main key point. I mean, there's some other things around on that topic itself, but a lot of it is how do we, become better, stronger, individually, communities, right, and then collective, as we, look for the strength of our association around the nation. So if you haven't planned to, please plan to attend next week's conference. If you want the details again, the website to register to complete the survey is at iwdmcommunity.com. That's iwdmcommunity.com. All the details for next week's conference is there, including the latest, or at least the final version of the agenda. So good segue to that. Are there any other, Danilo, anybody on your end have a question or comment before we close today's call?
Again, I'll check here and ask, please press 1 if you have any question or comment on AM360 Studio. Not seeing any hands being raised. I just like to comment too, alhamdulillah, and I concur with Imam Askir Muhammad Akil's comment and the presentation, and definitely it will connect and flow right in with the 50-year Human Family Strategic Planning Initiative. So thank you all. Thank you all so very much. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum.
I was going to say, if there's no other questions, I don't see you on hand raised. So,
I have a comment again.
Okay. So who is this? I can't recognize your voice.
That me.
Yeah, I was going to have you close the meeting. But go ahead.
Yes. As I see it, this is a maturing process, and that there is a need, in my opinion. We started off with a leadership model of residents and local or sectional leadership. And Imam described when he gave us the title of Imam, that Imam represents leading by example. That's how he described the meaning of Imam, leading by example. But in order to come into the productive and healthy future that we need, according to Imam Muhammad, who's left us, and I hope that we'll begin more and more to see Imam Muhammad in terms of the institutional memory, the pages and pages that he left us in terms of how we can navigate a healthy future here in America. And lastly, we need, well, we had the committee establishment among the believers inside the Muslim public, but we need qualified, educated men and women, and they are in our association, to come forward to, as Imam Muhammad put it, the need for them to come forward. We need those professional-minded men and women to translate their performance in a way that will or help to make the common man and woman more productive. And I'll give you one example. There's an imam in our association, Imam Salahuddin Hanif out of Albany. He was raised with his brothers to be builders. He builds very excellent homes and other structures, but he shared with a group of us that
assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and we are welcome. We are going to be with IWDM from 1 o'clock to 3 with Imam Sahir, a resident imam in Indianapolis, Indiana. So please stand by. Inshallah, we are going to connect you all with his program, inshallah.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to IWDM Radio. The program you are about to hear is a community service program on IWDM Radio. Please note, this content is not designed to provide specific personal, medical, legal, professional, or financial counsel or advice, and no liability shall extend to the host, guests, or agents with IWDM or Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio is not endorsed, sponsored, or certified by any third-party agency. Thank you for listening.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. I seek refuge, protection with Allah from Satan, the rejected enemy. With the name Allah, the merciful benefactor, the merciful redeemer. The day is October 15th, the year 2023, and you have tuned in for another session, production of Words My People. I'm your host, Michael Sahir. We'll be right back very shortly after our opening song. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to Words Made People. I'm your host, Michael Sahir. You're going to get invited to our program today. We're going to continue to follow our usual format. And that format includes reading words from the Holy Quran. You know that the show is titled Words Made People, and the best words, the best collection of words for making human beings are words that are contained in revelation, in the Word of God. Yes, words made people, but the best words, the best collection of words is the words of the Revelation, the Bible, Torah, and the Quran. And we as Muslims understand and make a claim, humbly but quite direct, that our book, the Quran, is the best collection of all the revelations because of its protection from Almighty God, Allah, highly glorified is He. So our reading today is going to be from chapter 4. Chapter 4, verse 135 is going to be our Quran reading for today. So give folks time to go to their bookshelf or get on their tablet or whatever. Look at chapter 4 of the Quran. Quran, chapter 4, verse 135. You know, before reading the Quran, we say two important phrases. We just don't begin reading. Our book is too important to begin reading. We're not reading the newspaper or magazine. We're reading the words of God. So there's two important phrases that we say before reading the Quran, And the first one is, "A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim." And that in English rendering is, "I seek refuge or protection with Allah, minash shaitan, away from shaitan, nir rajim, the rejected, accursed, open enemy to mankind." Then the second phrase you say before reading the Quran, except for chapter 9, we say, Bismillah ar-Rahim, with the name of God, the merciful benefactor, the merciful redeemer. And then we are ready to read. And it says here, Ya ayu elevena aminu, kunu kawamina bilkisti, shuhudan lillahi. And I read the first part of that. It says, in English it says, O you who believe, stand out firmly for justice as witnesses to Allah. As witnesses to Allah. It says, Shuhada lillahi, as witnesses to Allah. It's because it says, Walla allal asufikum, whether you are witness against yourself. It says, "As will al-waladin," or a witness against your parents. Or it says, "Wal al-karabina," or your kinfolk, your near kinfolk. If it be against, it says, "In yakun ganiyan," or whether you be a witness against those who are rich. It says, "Al-fakiran," or you be a witness against the poor. Allah is being very clear and quite specific, direct. It's saying that if you are a believer, you must stand firmly for justice. Justice, justice. That's the key words. As a witness to Allah, even as against yourself or your parents or your kin, or whether it be against the rich people or the poor people, it says, it tells us why, it says, Falahu Allah bihimma, because Allah can protect all of us, all of them. Allah is the one, he was the one to protect everybody involved. So stand for justice, tell the truth, no matter who it's against. Because Allah, as a witness to God, because Allah can protect everybody involved in this conversation. So it says, Sala tatabiyu, and do not follow your hawa. Well, that's the hawa, your desires, your heart. Don't be swayed by your desires, your hawa. Don't let your passion sway you from justice. It says, "Sala tatabiun el hawaya hawa an." He says, "Unless you," it says, "deviate, tatilude, deviate." In other words, you're supposed to be standing for justice. You're supposed to stand for what's right, regardless of who it is. Because she was standing as a witness for God, for what's right. And says, and don't follow your desires, otherwise you will deviate, you will swerve, you will go the wrong direction. And Allah says, and if you distort the truth or refrain or hold back the truth, sometimes you can't swerve from the truth, or sometimes you know the truth. You know what's right, but still you give in. And you just say, I ain't going to say anything because that's my mother or my father, or it's me. So I know what the truth is, so I'm not going to say anything. The Quran says, if you do that, if you say nothing, when you know what is right, Allah says, we are wrong. We are following the desires, the passions of our hawa, our desires, our desires. Allah says, فإن الله كان بما تعملون كبيرا. Allah says, verily Allah is well acquainted with all that you do. So we are given clear instructions, a clear mandate. And it didn't say, oh, you Muslims, or oh, you Christians, it said, oh, you who believe. Anybody who believes, we have an obligation to tell the truth, tell the whole truth. This is, again, chapter 4, verse 135 of the Quran. Don't let our passion soul, oh, I like this person, you know, or I'm going to favor this person, therefore I'm not going to give true testimony. I'm going to be a false witness because I don't want to hurt their feelings, or maybe the person is rich. You say, be it someone rich or the poor. It may be rich and powerful. So you say, well, if I tell the truth on the rich and powerful, they may not give me any more favors. Or they may use their power and come back and attack me. So I'm going to just either lie or don't say nothing. And in this case here, not saying anything is like, it's the same as lying. But they say silence becomes consent. So Allah is telling us we must stand firm upon justice. And that's the key word here, dear people. Stand firm upon what is just, what is right, and just. And that's the key word. It says, build, that's saying with or for justice, for justice. If we can keep that rule in mind, then we can make a lot of progress in life because Allah is the one best to protect us all. Alhamdulillah, he'll be allowed to me. Yeah, so that's our reading for today of the Quran. And we're going to get into our conversation. Now, after reading the Quran, the Muslim will say, Sadaqallahu al-Azim. Sadaqallah. He's saying Allah has spoke the truth, but he tells you what kind of truth it is. It's Al-Azim, and Azim means the mighty truth. So upon completing reading of the Quran, you say Allah has spoken, and Allah has spoken a mighty truth. Alhamdulillah, he'll be allowed to meet. That completes our reading for today for this program. We're going to get into our conversation. I chose a name for, sometimes I choose a title for my production, and I go read it again a day or two later. I say, was that too harsh? Was that too direct? Because sometimes you have to be direct. We're living in serious times, dear people, as we know. And as 8 days ago, it increased, it intensified with Hamas in Israel, and that's a difficult situation for us. It has the ramifications. The fallout is going to be very serious. Our program today is to bring a light. You don't want to bring passion. You don't want to bring hate or anger. But we want to bring light to the situation. I have two very important guests coming on today. I had a third person, a local rabbi, but he's not feeling well. But so he's not able to join us today. But he did send us his support and his prayers. But I do have two very important guests I'm going to bring on very, very shortly because I know time is of the essence. But I just want to say a few words to kind of set the tone, if we may. And the reason why that I chose that verse from the Quran, because it is an obligation for us to be truthful, to tell the truth, to not hold back from telling the truth. We have to be those who are honest and not pick sides, even if it goes against our own personal selves. This would bring us to, hopefully, a point in life of being, having a resolve in ourselves for truth, and to build coalitions of relationships with those of similar minds to a lot of these ugly, sinful moments in our life we can get past. So we're going to have a conversation today about what happened last Saturday October 7th in Israel. But then we also want to have a conversation on what happened 75 years before that. You cannot differentiate the two. And 2 days before October 7th, on the 5th, that I had lunch with a different rabbi in Indianapolis. You know, we're friends. And we went out for lunch and just caught up with old times, you know, how's the family. And we always exchanged some religious thoughts about what's common in our religion and also what's common in our two languages, the religion, the language of Islam is Arabic and the language of the Jewish people is Hebrew. And there's a lot of similarities of their sister languages. And we just had a typical good conversation, good lunch. Just within 24 hours, all hell, and I mean hell, broke loose with Hamas attacking the people in Israel. And I'm like, my goodness. I was really glad we had the lunch before because we had no idea this was coming. After it happened, you know, I reached out to various friends, Muslim, Christians, and Jews, and to three rabbis, the two I mentioned plus the third one, and let them know. I said, look, there's nothing in the Quran that supports Hamas or anybody for that matter attacking innocent people. I'm not going to spend not 1 second, not even a half a second, trying to defend what is obviously wrong, un-Islamic, what is against the Quran, the spirit of the Quran. It is against the life model of Muhammad the prophet. There's nothing in his life that supports that. In fact, the truth be told, there are verses in the Quran that speaks directly against attacking innocent people. There's the life model of Muhammad over and over again that speaks against attacking. So as Muslims, let us keep our book, excuse the phone ringing, I'm sorry. As Muslims, let us be first and foremost in not defending wrong. Now we know there's a history behind that. We're going to get into that. But don't convolute the two. If right is right and wrong is wrong. So don't get the idea we're not here to choose sides in that regard. But we are going to choose each person on their free, independent, conscious mind can come to their conclusion as to what is justice on both sides. So I titled this program, Israeli-Pakistani Saga. Innocent blood in hands. And I emphasize there's innocent blood on both sides of the equation and guilty hands on both sides of the equation. So I just wanted to just say that first. We're not going to sugarcoat anything, but we're not going to bring, if anybody who calls it a day, call them any hate or anger in their voice, then I'm going to cut you off. If you begin name calling and making comments that will not help, I'm going to give up. I'm going to cut you off, okay? You've been told. I may say it again for those who call in later. Our show today is to have an honest conversation. You can bring your passion. You can bring your commitment. We want to hear that. But don't bring hatred. Don't bring violence. Don't be none of that. I will cut you off because this is words made people, and we're here to build understanding. And so if you on one side or the other, that's okay, but don't bring any hate. Okay, we're going to get into our conversation. I'm going to bring on first, because her schedule is a little bit shorter today, Dr. Mary Ann Sadeh. She's a local resident of Indianapolis, Indiana. I've known her for, I don't know, I lost track, Sister Mary Ann. Sister Mary Ann, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.
Yeah, welcome to Words Made People.
Thank you.
Just for the benefit of our listening audience, to keep in mind, these shows are archived like forever. So if someone may tune in next year and hear this program, just give us a 5-second, 10-second thumbnail as to who is Mary Ann today.
Well, that's quick. I've got a PhD in Arabic and Islamic studies. I had traveled to the Middle East, fact-finding mission back in 2001, summer of 2001 with the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Saw some tragic things and learned a lot of things that really shocked me. Foremost was the fact that Americans were being lied to. They weren't being given the truth about what was going on over there. And the group of us who were there as delegates, I have to say that after we saw both sides and we visited, spent a night having dinner and spent the night with a Jewish family, a rabbi, I believe, and another family was Palestinian. And so we went to met settlers, met peace advocates on both sides. We just saw the whole range, a spectrum of Israeli society and Palestinian society. I have to say that afterwards, I think every one of us came away with sympathy for the Palestinians when we saw what kind of life that they were put under, and the stress and the trauma and the breaking of international law constantly. I know how the Jews must have felt in Nazi Germany, because that's how I sensed, I was feeling, even though I'm not Palestinian, but I sensed that I'm up for the people of Palestine as well. And God bless the peace advocates on both sides. There was an organization where the parents on both sides had lost children, and they came together. Mm-hmm. And I was really touched by that, because I think the worst nightmare of a parent is to lose a child, and both mm-hmm. sides had lost children. So they instead of fueling hatred and vengeance, they wanted to come together and grieve and try to find a way to promote peace. And I really applaud them for that, and all peacemakers, because it's a hard thing to do when your emotions may tell you otherwise, but it's the higher path. Right. And there's no religion that would accept killing people, and no all true believers should really unite to condemn these atrocities on both sides, because for over 50 years now, the Palestinians have been living in almost squalor, especially in Gaza. I saw a terrible situation there. I mean, people had next to nothing, and yet they were so gracious and hospitable with their kindness and behavior and just patience and resilience. I was amazed. I saw people who whose home were surrounded by settlers, and they were beaten and everything just for wanting to add a bedroom to their home.
Wow.
And the sprinkling system of the old man, the patriarch of the family, it had a little garden. They tore it up. I mean, they just beat up his wife. She was an older woman. I mean, I just could not believe. Of course, they beat up the younger ones too. But I just couldn't believe people could be that insensitive, because they were just peacefully living their lives. They didn't bother the settlers at all, and yet the settlers just wanted them out and was doing everything they could to harass them. And Amnesty International had documented all of that. So I was really shocked that the U.S. is
right now,
blind. Blind.
Go ahead, sorry.
I'm sorry, did you say something I didn't get? Yes?
No, I just wanted to clarify, when you say the settlers, you're referring to the Jewish settlers?
Yes, they had surrounded. They were surrounding the home of these couple of Palestinians. I think other people had just fled, I'm not sure, but they were trying to stay in their home. And they were being harassed daily.
Yes, yes. Yes, you know, the incident that happened last Saturday, it shocked the world, to be honest about it, you know, for so many reasons. Israel is known to have one of the better security systems in the world, and it's caught everyone totally off guard. What came to your mind, knowing your history or your travel in that region, what came to your mind when you first heard the reports from last Saturday on the 7th of October?
I was absolutely shocked. I mean, it was a terrible thing that was done. I definitely condemn that. I mean, anyone who is a believer would condemn that.
Right.
But I just thought it was rather suspicious, frankly, that they were able to get in like that, because Israel has a barricade like no other. The walls they put up, the barricades, I've lost count of how many, over 600 barricades, their lives of pure hell, standing in line constantly to go somewhere, to even to your own farmlands. They have a wall built between the home and their homes and their vineyards and olive groves, and it's just
describe
their
wall for
it's terrible.
Can,
but this surprised me.
Yeah, Ken, can you describe the wall? When I was there in 2008 with the interfaith team, you know, going from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, I saw cement walls. Of course, I didn't measure them, but they had to be every bit of 2 stories tall, if not taller, 25 feet tall cement walls. Well, are those the same kind of barriers that you were referring to?
Well, that's one of the barriers. Others are mounds. Others are gates and crossings and all sorts of barriers. We had a hard time. We had to wait to go through some of them, checkpoints as well. And since we were a group of, you know, Americans, they let us through. But I could see how the Palestinians were in another camp and just waiting sometimes hours to get through. And they try to wear them down, basically.
Yes. Yeah.
Prevent much movement within their own territory.
Well, I witnessed the same thing in 2008. And they did us the same way, but they still were Americans. They kind of gave us a little pass. We still had to go through that turnstile, that metal turnstile, but they were not. They didn't ask us for ID or anything. But the Palestinians each, and they were going to work or from work. They had to show their ID. At this point here, I want to bring on my other guest, Leif Carlson. Leif Carlson. I'll let him introduce himself. But he too has had experiences there in that region. Leif, welcome to Words My People.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, it's my honor. Can you give us a thumbnail picture of who you are so as they hear you speak, they can have a better understanding of who they're listening to?
Well, thank you for having me. So my first exposure to essentially the conflict was I was part of a college program the summer of 2000, going to do something completely unrelated, but in Israel, doing underwater archaeology for the summer. And I returned, you know, we did the typical tours that Westerners do where we, you know, take the bus into Bethlehem to go buy olive wood and then return. But that was like the only real exposure to the West Bank for me that summer. And I got home about 2 weeks before the second intifada began. And I was, to be honest, I was completely ignorant of the conflict. But I was really mesmerized and, you know, obviously devastated by what I was seeing in the news. But also just really wanting to learn as much as I possibly could. So that kind of began my, you know, my journey to studying the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. I started studying Arabic the next year at a university where I lived at the time in Fargo, North Dakota, and then began applying to graduate programs. And the next year I started a master's in peace and justice at Earlham School of Religion in Richmond, Indiana. It's a Quaker school where I was able to study kind of like almost like an independent study with my master's to focus on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Was there for 3 years, and then in 2005, I graduated, and that summer I went and lived in the West Bank in Bethlehem. It was through a partnership program, an organization in Bethlehem called Holy Land Trust, and they put you with a family to live as host family for the summer. You have an internship, and I was interning at WIAM, which is the Palestinian Conflict Resolution Center, also in Bethlehem. And then, traveling all the time, seeing things for ourselves, just kind of witnessing what life was like on the ground for Palestinians. And then we were also studying Arabic as well at a local university. And then that summer, I was fortunate to be selected as one of the four of us who were invited into Gaza. It was the way it worked then. I have since understand that now it's next to impossible for internationals, unless you actually are an employee of an aid organization. It's very hard to get to go into Gaza. But at the time, the only way one could go was you had to be invited by an existing aid organization who already had a presence on the ground in Gaza. And the organization that I went through was an organization called Norwegian People's Aid, and they're an international granting organization, and they were, giving out grant money to lots of different NGOs within the Gaza Strip. And so for the week that I was there, kind of my role was to help with, there was a youth kind of summit, a camp for, and when they say youth in Palestine, I'm sure it's very true for a lot of other Arab countries as well. Youth is basically anything up through, like, essentially even mid-20s. And so a lot of the youth I was working with were college-aged youth. And it was all about civic responsibility, importance of volunteerism, things like that. And then also to help the NGO, help Norwegian People's Aid with their sort of grant compliance work, where we would travel around to the different organizations that they were helping fund, and just making sure that there was compliance with how the money was being used and things like that. But all along, what we're really doing is, again, witnessing what life is like on the ground for Palestinians in Gaza. And of course, you have to see a lot of, both talk with Marianne said, just a lot of horrible things, but also met some of those amazingly wonderful people who, I will just say, I can't imagine my life not having done that 1 week experience in Gaza. It has completely defined my worldview. It's pretty remarkable to look back at that and to think about how, I can't imagine my life not having done that, and then in 2008, I was invited to come back to Palestine to co-lead that summer experience for other students essentially coming over. So I was a co-leader that summer as well. But Gaza was not available at that time for us to go and see that. So, yeah.
Why not? Why was Gaza not available in 2008?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, we talked about that. I think we might have overlapped because you also had visited, I think, Holy Land Trust when you were on that delegation, correct?
We went to Mary Bethlehem, and we began in Jordan, building a house of Habitat for Humanity, and went down to Jordan, the southern Jordan, across the Dead Sea into Israel, or Jerusalem, I should say, and then across next to Jerusalem to Bethlehem. And we were there with an interfaith group, about 15 of us. And there was a rabbi in the group. As a matter of fact, I see my rabbi friend's number has lit up, so he will be able to join us. But I was there in 2008, but we did not go nowhere near Gaza. We were mainly in Jerusalem, the old city, and in Bethlehem.
Yeah.
But there was a contradiction between Bethlehem, where the Palestinians are, compared this to the senior wall. And this is my personal expression, because I served as a chaplain for years at a local prison in Indiana, and the walls were the same kind of walls. The prison in Indiana were very similar to the walls. They divided Bethlehem from Jerusalem. So,
right.
Yes, and it was quite revealing, as I was telling some of our youth today, trying to get a pulse of where their mind was. And on top of the houses of Palestinians, it was a big, big tub, like a big vat to hold hundreds of gallons of water. And I said, well, what are those things on the house? And they said, oh, that is their water tank. Once a month, the Israelis bring them water. And if there was more, if they ran out of water before the month was over with, it was shame on them. But I do see my friend, my rabbi friend, Lou Weiss, he's not feeling the best, but he's going to try and speak with us for a while. I'd love to bring him on this moment. And then we can open up for a conversation with everyone. Is this my friend, Rabbi Lou Weiss? How you doing, sir?
Pretty good, Mikhail. Thank you very much. I just wanted to get on for a second. I'm not talking too well or anything like that, but I appreciate what you're doing. I thank you for that. And your speakers, I just wanted to say that I hope we can treat each other with love and respect and, you know, to care for each other and work together for peace and justice. There's so many things in this world I don't understand, but I think we have to hold on to hope, and that's what I'm hanging on to. I work with some of these organizations, Rabbis for Human Rights and the Friends and Families of Combatants that Marianne, I think, was talking about, maybe, Peace Now and Trua, which is another, concern about human rights of all people. And that's what I want to speak for now.
I know you can't speak much, but I do want to ask, when you hear the news October 7th, of the Hamas attacking the Israelis, what went through your mind?
Well, I have to admit, this whole time, I've been dealing with COVID and on medicine for that, so I haven't been very aware of things. But all I can say is shock and disbelief. I mean, I understand there's a history there. I am sorry for that history. But I also can't believe that people can do these kind of things particularly to for who are at a peace concert. And I've been to many of them. People in shelters, families with elderly, it's just beyond my belief and understanding. I guess that's all I can say.
Yes, sir. Before you go, help me and my listening audience to understand, because we hear terms, then we hear Jew, then we hear Jewish, then we hear Zionist. Are they all one and the same, or is there a difference?
Wow, and I don't want to get into too much because like everything, it's very complicated. There are Jews who are not Zionists. The majority of Jews probably are Zionists. I consider myself maybe a progressive liberal Zionist. I think of the times of Martin Buber and Ernst Simon and Ehud, which worked for, had a hope that there could be a Palestinian, back then they used the term more just Arab or Muslim. I don't think they understood completely, but that's the, my hope and belief is that you can have a progressive Middle East where people work together for everybody's benefit. And that's where I am. It's very complex. There are organizations that don't believe in Zionism. That's not where I am right now. I'm not sure.
Right.
This is where I am. I think everybody has a right.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Now, I'm just curious, if you were to put in a few words to define the word Zionist, what would you say in just a few words?
Well, originally I kind of saw it as the, the National Liberation Movement of the Jewish people. But I also do believe in some way that the Jewish people have a historical connections with the Promised Land, the Holy Land, whatever we want to call it. And I don't think it's the way it is now. It's not that connection, I don't think. But I think there is a historical connection there, and there is a right there. But, I think it's based on, in my opinion, love and concern for one another. And that was the original idea of Zionism. I mean, it was socialism. It was concern, and a lot of that has changed, certainly under current government of Israel. And that's what concerns me greatly.
Yes, sir. Okay, but I'm going to leave your mic open. You know, I don't want to overwork you because you're trying to deal with your health. But I'm going to leave your mic open. You can put your own phone on mute in case you want to come back in later on. Would it be okay for you?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I can't say how much I can stay on because I don't control my body very well right now. Appreciate our being friends and working together, and you've talked about our trip many years ago under an interfaith organization of Muslim, Jewish, Christian to Jordan and building a home for a Palestinian cab driver and working with refugees, Iraqi refugees, and going into Palestine, going into Israel, working with, meeting with some progressive Israeli organizations that are concerned about Palestinian rights and freedom. So I thought that was so exciting and so meaningful. I wish we could do it again. I wish I was in a condition to do that again. I hope we can.
Yes,
we even wanted
definitely.
To go into Syria, of all places, and which would maybe have been dangerous. I don't know, but I mean, dangerous part of human life. But that was such a great experience for me, and I think it made a difference in the world. And, I might be naive, but I think it made a difference.
Yes, me too. I definitely hope so. Okay, so I'm gonna leave your phone line open. You can put your phone on mute and you can come in as you need to come in. Mary Ann, Rabbi Lou Weiss, he mentioned something that you similar to what you said. There's a lot of good organizations, activity going on. You mentioned about the mothers who have both lost Israeli and Palestinian mothers who united. Those things tend not to make the news. There's a lot of things that go on in the area that don't make the news. What are your thoughts on that? Why are those things not making, those good things not making the news?
It's intentional, I'm afraid. I many years ago when I was a graduate student and I worked in the part-time work in the Office of Middle Eastern Studies program. I was the outreach coordinator, and we held lots of programs, brought in speakers, mostly cultural things, speakers on Middle Eastern culture, but at times it got into politics, especially when there was some drama in the Middle East. And a survey came to my desk, and I don't remember who conducted the survey, but it was anonymous. And they this would be the early 80s, they had surveyed all the broadcasting stations around the country and asked for an anonymous answer so they could say what they wanted, no one would know who they are. And every one of them, not one without any exception, which really startled me, every one of them said that if the news was favorable to Israel, they would broadcast it or publish it. And if it was not, they would withheld it. And just the opposite for the Palestinians. Anything positive or favorable to the Palestinians, they withheld, and anything negative, they broadcast. And so I realized that over these decades, they have been grooming public opinion, or, you know, in such a way that you don't hear much when Israelis kill, torture, and maim Palestinians. In fact, one little young man was just killed a few days ago, and before October 7th, and he was shot. And he was just maybe 14 years old, shot in the neck, paralyzed from the neck down, and then later died. And he was just standing around. He hadn't done anything. He was just a civilian in a group of people, and they just indiscriminately shot at him. This is the reason why most Americans feel that the Palestinians are terrorists. But I wish people would practice the golden rule, because you should walk a mile in their shoes, or even one day be in their shoes. No Israeli could tolerate what's being done to them. And the irony is they want peace, but the Israelis don't want peace. And they keep making an excuse, which is not true, that there's no legitimate partner on the other side, but that they themselves don't want peace. They made peace with Egypt, but they refused to make peace with, Syria and Palestinians.
Now, on that survey, it was anonymous on the part of the station. Again, how many stations were on the survey, and were these only American stations, or was these stations from around the world?
No, these were just American, U.S. I don't recall the number. I don't recall at all. I mean, it was a good number, but I would guess 100 at most.
Okay.
But I don't recall at all. It's been that long. But a person, they all said the same thing, and that's what was sad and, I mean, shocking, really, because we're supposed to have freedom of speech, but obviously that's not the case.
Right. So, yes. Lee, for any observations you want to make at this time, because there's so much to cover, and I want to get further into it, but I want to hear from you as well.
No, I think, I agree with everything that's been said, and one of the things that kind of struck me in the last week, just like what Marion was saying about, kind of the media representation, because the 7th was a Saturday, and I had to wait until Monday before I started seeing any of kind of the news sources that I trust were able to start covering it, because they don't operate on the weekends. So all weekend long, just being inundated with media that was very slanted, only really showing one side. And, obviously I was really devastated by the news, but I wanted kind of more of an unbiased sort of perspective, and I was really relying on some of those sources. So I was eagerly waiting Monday for when I could start to, see some, more from the Palestinian perspective. It's really tough. My question has always been, where has the media been for the last, even just talking specifically about Gaza, where have they been for the last 16 years during the blockade? Where have they been, I always wonder that. Marion's comment really answers the question, and that is that if it's not coming from a particular perspective, they're not going to cover it. I echo what everyone's been saying.
Let's say expand it, because I would give my personal perspective. And I really like President Joe Biden. I voted for him last time. I probably vote for him again. I was highly let down by his response. And the main reason was, I guess, waiting for the balance. I didn't hear him get the balance. It was the Jewish people, yes, that they were hurt by the attack. And that's understood. And a mile from home, just like Mr. Joe Biden, should balance. There are Palestinian babies killed. There were Palestinian old women killed as well. But it's kind of like closing the eye and saying, if you're going there and just kill, and this is why we read that verse from the Quran, you can't let one wrong make you do another. So getting beyond the media on our political landscape, I found it quite difficult to hear from many of our politicians across the spectrum, pretty much. Not all, but what,
yeah.
What's your take on that? That's a question to both of you, both Elise and Marianne.
You don't mind, I'll just share something really quickly about that. I agree with you completely. I will say, though, I was not surprised from the response from the president. I've always been really kind of critical of his. He's been very vocal. I remember in 2008 when he was still in consideration for, he was running against, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and he was being interviewed, and he was bragging about being a Christian Zionist into the interviewer, and he kept talking about you don't have to be a Jew to be a Zionist. Do you know that, right? And he kept saying that. And so I at that time started doing some digging, and I was in Palestine that summer when all the kind of primary stuff was going on, and I was really watching what he was saying and going back and looking at his record, and he's very staunchly Christian Zionist. So I wasn't surprised. I think what stunned me more in his speech was that no one on his team thought to really vet the information that he was going to be using as a justification for supporting Israel in this situation. They were quoting things, atrocities that happened on the 7th that now we believe in the international community never happened, and that they was using it in a sense as a justification for our support. To me, it's kind of like whenever you see like a courtroom drama and somebody on the stand says something, and the judge might say, oh, we want that stricken from the record. Jury, please disregard what, this witness has just said. I always wonder, how are they supposed to not remember what was just said? And I felt that way, when this kind of misinformation is being spread, and it's being spread from, essentially one of the most powerful people in the world, it's really hard to walk that back, even if there's no information to support that. So I was really more surprised by that there was really little regard for seeking out truth and just saying kind of anything they've been hearing on social media. I just kind of expected more, So that's just what I want to say.
Yeah, the media, yes. Marianne, what are your thoughts about the reaction from our politicians to October 7th?
Well, I was horrified because there's no nuanced approach to politics anymore. Everything is handled with war and weapons instead of diplomacy. They don't bother to find out the circumstances. They just go right in and, like cowboys, almost just shooting up whatever. They want to send all the weapons. And I just read on, watched the program, the news two couple of days ago, and I think it was NPR or PBS that they put on a comment after the segment, as they normally do, and it's that this year alone, Israel has received $153 billion in aid, and
okay,
most of that,
a billion.
$153 billion has gone to Israel in this year alone, and most of it goes, and there's no accountability. They can spend it however they like. And a lot of times, technically Israel does not qualify for our foreign aid because of their GDP, but it's against the law according to our own regulations. No other country with their GDP of Israel's GDP would qualify for foreign aid, and yet they're getting all this. So the bias is just unbelievable, and I'm just shocked and saddened by the fact that nobody bothers to do any investigating before they decide who is the guilty party. And yes, it sounds obvious that Hamas and whoever they were somehow got in. Maybe they were, as I say, I was really suspicious about how they easily could get in. It seems very strange,
yeah,
but
too.
But what they did was horrendous, and everyone should condemn it. But we should also condemn what Israel has been doing for the last 50, 60 years. And the U.S. is not an honest broker. If they were, they would have stopped this way back in 1967, but they chose not to. And so it's just escalated. And all the settlements that keep being built, they're, you know, it's against the law, but they turn a blind eye to whatever they do. So I'm really saddened because I had a Jewish friend in grad school, and she was a history major. And we were talking about something, maybe some flare-up in the Middle East. So I was asking her what she thought. And she told me, and she was an American Jewish of Russian and East European background. And she told me that her grandmother had lived in Palestine peacefully with everyone before the Nazi persecution and before all the European Jews started coming to Israel. And when she told them, her grandmother said to her, she said to the incoming Jews who were creating havoc, she said, "We lived in peace until you showed up." And it's really true, because there were some very sad stories of very nice Palestinians who welcomed them because they realized they'd been persecuted, welcomed them. These were Christian Palestinians at the time, welcomed them to, and they actually had prepared a feast for them so that when they came, they would see that these people are not against them. Well, those Jewish people who showed up, "Can you go out for a picnic for a few days and let us," I don't know what the excuse they made, but they asked them if they would just go for a picnic and spend some time in their vineyards and whatever, and do, you know, just relax, enjoy themselves. I mean, I really don't know what kind of excuse you could give someone to say, "Would you please leave for a week?" But they did it, and they came back and found their homes occupied. So, yeah. You know, there are lots of sad stories on both sides, but there are a lot of good people who want peace, and it's just the powers that be and the governments that really are supporting that, I believe. Yeah. I met a lot of good Israelis, as well as wonderful Palestinians, just wonderful people who really wanted peace and were not allowed to have it, to live in peace.
Yeah, and let me do this here, because I had two calls on hold. They've been on hold for a while. Please go ahead and make your comment.
I was just going to add one last thing about the politician side of it, too. That was something else that I read in a report this week that I found to be really troubling as well, and that is, in the last week, stocks in military corporations have gone up, you know, exponentially, right? Because when there's war, their profits, you know, everyone sees this, oh, this is a good investment. And the reports are is that there is still no regulation on United States politicians' ability to invest. These are people who are sometimes on committees that know this information ahead of time, and they're able to invest in these you know, war profiteering companies. In my opinion, they have no political but also no financial reason to want there to be peace, because they are going to be making money off of conflict. And so that, to me, is really, really troubling, you know, when people who are supposed to be making, you know, regulations and that are really essentially affecting global policy have the ability to profit off of war, then there's no real reason for them to want peace.
So what you're saying, just to reiterate, we have U.S. politicians who are giving, like, insider trade information. You can put it another way. That a war is coming, and these same politicians are investing in weaponry, bombs and bullets, because they know that their investment is going to have a substantial return.
Yes.
And that is very troubling, because the consequences is the killing of the innocent. That's the title of this program today, Innocent Blood on Guilty Hands, and you have expanded the conversation. Dear listener, I'm going to get to my calls. I had a couple of calls. I had three to my first caller, at least. Caller from 818. Thanks for calling Words Made People. Can you give us your first name and your city and your question or comment, please? 818-400. You're on. Okay, we're going to put him back on hold and go to our next caller. Okay, it's a caller here from 773-414. Thanks for calling Words Made People. Can you give us your first name and your city?
Assalamu alaikum. This is Brother Bashir from Chicago. Welcome to our guests. And I appreciate their observations in this situation. And as you pointed out, Imam Sahir, we want to be just in this situation. Allah guides us to be just, in a situation like this, and even if we have to accuse our own self, to be just. And I think that's what the essence of this situation that has existed since 1948.
Yes.
In Palestine is about justice. But I was recently reading in Quran, and as the sister talked about, and many people who have visited Israel in that situation talk about the injustices that are done to the Palestinian people. And I was recently reading in the Quran, and, the Quran, and this particular verse from the Quran, is addressing the Jews. But as we understand, Allah, when he points out errors that people have made in the past, it's a lesson for all of us. And although this was addressing the Jews, it was also addressing humanity not to make those same errors and those same mistakes. So just briefly, this is from Surah the Heights, Al-Afra, 157 and 158. I'll try and be short. So now the mercy has been assigned to those who follow the messenger, the only prophet whose mention they shall find in the Torah and the gospel.
I'm breaking up. Brother Bashir, when you begin reading the Quran verse, your phone begins to break up. So if you can repeat the chapter number and verse again, if you can.
Okay. Again. Can you hear me? Can you hear me now?
I can now.
Are you able to hear me?
You were very clear. You were very clear until you began reading the Quran verse, and then your phone began to break up. Go ahead, please.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So this is from Surah 7, the Heights, Al-Ara, 157 and 158. So now mercy has been assigned to those who follow the messenger, the only prophet, whose mention they shall find in the Torah and the gospel with them. He enjoins them to follow virtue and forbids them from evil. He makes pure things lawful for them and impure things unlawful. Now I want to go to the commentary. And this is from Maldudi's translation. And here he says, use of the word Ummi for the Holy Prophet is very significant. This title was used to break the national pride and arrogance of the Jews, who called non-Jews Ummis or Gentiles. In this respect, they were so arrogant that as a nation, not to speak of acknowledging a Ummi as the leader, they were not ready even to concede basic human rights to the Gentiles. They asserted, we are not to be called to account for our behavior toward the Gentiles. So as the our guest has pointed out, some of the atrocities we see happening to the Palestinians from the Jewish government there, it goes back to what Allah has pointed out and warned us. He pointed out to Jews, but it's a warning to all humanity, is when they take on this kind of thinking and this kind of attitude, they can do these type of atrocities, not only the Jews, the Muslims, the Christians, and others. If we don't follow the correct guidance, then we cause problems for ourselves and problems for others. And I think it's very significant. The brother pointed out that Biden said he was a Christian Zionist. That's significant. And also the sister that pointed out that they didn't have a problem, they didn't have a problem until the Nazi Jews came. The man Wadi Muhammad pointed out to us, he made this observation, that he felt the atrocities that this government was put on was because of the situation they experienced under the Nazis. And they were using that same kind of mentality on the Palestinians. And there's a situation where if somebody grows up in an abusive family, they may be abusive. That's what I'm like.
Yes. Like my son, they say, hurt people tend to hurt people. You made one comment, Brother Bashir, that he called, he said the Nazi Jews, and I think he was referring to the Jews that were abused by the Nazis. I think that's what you meant to say.
Yes.
I just wanted to clarify that. Mary Ann or Leif, and also Lou, whenever you want to comment, you can unmute yourself. Do you have any comments on what Bashir just said? Okay.
I would just say, thank you, obviously, for that perspective. It's a challenging time, for many, many people, and I think to be pursuing other people's perspectives is really important right now. So
I would like to say that normally translated as illiterate, the illiterate prophet, because he had never been taught to read and write, and so it was to emphasize that he could not have made up the Quran, for example, because he was illiterate. And I've never heard it translated as prophet, but it's the illiterate. Ummi means he is unschooled. So he was very intelligent, didn't have, what you say, book learning, so to speak. But the Quran was a revelation that came to him. So that's why it was emphasized that he was illiterate, because people had accused him of making it up. But I'd never heard the other definition that caller used.
Yeah. Okay, great. Okay, Brother Bashir, we thank you very much. We're going to go to our next caller here. Caller, I'm going to try this 818 number a second time. Caller from 818-400, you're on Voice Made People. Do you have a question or comment, please? Okay. Go to our next caller here from 856. 856-718, thanks for calling Voice Made People. Can you give us your first name, your city, and your question and comment, please?
I'll comment. My name is Latana Ali. I'm from New Jersey.
Yes, ma'am.
I just read recently that, Walikum Islam, and I know it to be a fact also, because I did some work for some, told me that they wanted their Jewish name back because their grandfather had changed their name to avoid dictation during the Nazi regime. So we know that there were some Jews that went into the army of Hitler's army. Okay, so we know that. But when we look at what happened in America, and then we look at what happened in Germany, and we're looking at what happened in Israel, it's all the same kind of scenario, beat up people and the weaker ones, huh? Okay, Thank you. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam. Thank you, Sister Tatana. Iman, have a comment on what she shared?
Well, we do tend to create wars and start wars, and support wars. We're not the light on the hill that we thought we were. And it saddens me because I love this country and I love what it stood for originally. I'm sorry that it has lost its way, its moral compass. If it had one, is definitely not in service now. Everything is about money and exploiting others. And it's sad because there's so many good people in this country who are naive politically, don't realize what our government is doing. And if we could just have our country back and have maybe term limits so we wouldn't have career politicians who would keep dictating the same policies and have a change of leadership more often, then I think we might be able to prevent further catastrophes in the world. And there are so many, not just the Palestinian issue, but around the world, there are just so many refugees that have been created, some by the global warming, some by our policies in past decades in the South America, for example. And if we would just do the right thing and practice the golden rule and realize that we are all given, blessed with the divine in us, everybody has that. Maybe some of us, many of us don't see it, don't act like it, but it's there. And if we would just treat people with kindness and respect, and that goes for the police in our country toward especially black people, but in general, if we would just do the right thing, try to be civil, be respectful, know that you can't love God without loving his creation, and we're all part of his creation. And that means human beings as well as animals and plants, and just be respectful, just take what you need, don't exploit the land. If we all just did that, it would be a tremendous, it would be almost like a paradise. If we could just live and let live and help people in need. During COVID and two, three years back, even nature was being restored because we weren't running around like crazy people and driving and flying and this and that, and nature was able to come back. We can restore nature, we can restore people if we would just make the effort. And believe me, in doing so, we would be happy, because I can't think of a happier thing for someone than knowing that you have made a positive difference in the life of someone else, even if you don't know that person. We've lost that light in us. We're forgetting the light in us. And many of us, thank God, there are many people who are doing the right thing, and I know that there are people concerned about the environment, people concerned about children in war zones. I mean, there are just so many wonderful organizations, but we need in this country to just realize that we have to make a change in our policies. We can't be condemning everybody and going to war with everybody. We need to let diplomacy and self-respect become the norm, because we're always talking about our national interests, but we don't care about anyone else's national interests, apparently. We don't respect other people, especially if they're not Westerners. And this is a sad thing, because we have a lot to learn from these people. They have wonderful cultures and traditions. I learned so much when I was in the Middle East. I was really wishing that, you know, we had that here, because the societies were healthier. I'm talking about vis-a-vis children and their families. Children were safer in the families. I mean, they were, of course, there was trauma, but outside. But the love and the close knitness of the families in the Middle East is something amazing to see and wonderful. And I know we were like that, and we're still like that, many of us, but not as much before. And that's what's sad. But in general, I just think if we followed the golden rule, that we would be blessing everyone, and we would be blessed ourselves.
Thank you very much. Very well said. Lisa, any comments? I have a question.
Something to the what the caller had brought up, just like kind of the idea of a pattern, right? That this what has happened to the horribleness of the Holocaust and what happened to Jewish people and others who are marginalized, kind of repeating itself, right? And seeing similar patterns, mm-hmm. even what's going on with Palestinians. Something that I really was thinking about was this idea of nonviolence, right? And the kind of the benefits of nonviolence, but specifically for thinking about the Jewish narrative, that for a people who have been so affected by violence, right, and whose story is connected to violence, that unfortunately by now kind of perpetuating a kind of, just the collective violence that's being perpetrated against Palestinians. In a way, what's happening is it's kind of still married to this narrative of violence. And I think that a nonviolent mm-hmm. response would help to liberate themselves from that narrative, and that it mm-hmm. shouldn't be coming from an external sort of pressure. This shouldn't be a mandate that some other country or agency is telling you must, choose nonviolence or you must stop, but something within themselves to seek within themselves and find that nonviolence is the way to liberate themselves. And it's for all of us, not just for the Jewish people, but and for Israelis, mm-hmm. but just in general, for sure, thinking about their narrative of, what happened to them as sort of being the victims of violence and now unfortunately being, kind of perpetrators of it, it's really sad to me. So I was just thinking about the role of nonviolence and how it's not just passivity, but it's seeking liberation within ourselves.
Yes. You make a good point. We have a very good model there of the African-American struggle in the USA of nonviolence and the benefits that came from that. And I noticed when I was in Bethlehem, on their walls, even the walls inside of some of their buildings on the staircase, I was really happily surprised to see how many quotes they had of African-American leaders. Angelo, Dr. King, and others. I was like, the Palestinians have been studying the African-American struggle. I was happy. I'm really, myself being African-American. But the question I wanted to ask, if my callers, please be patient. Now, we'll get to my callers, so please be patient. The question I want to ask is, what was going through, I know this is, you can't give a direct answer, but what could have been going through the minds of Hamas to have planned such an atrocious attack, knowing the vengeance that Israel can have in the past? Hamas had to have calculated that it's going to cause them to lose it's apparently that they're going to lose the babies, their own mothers. What was going through their mind when they made that attack, knowing that Israel controls the waterway, their utilities, their food supply, their medical supplies? What could have been going through their mind? Because we know Hamas in 2006 was a properly democratically elected body by the people.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's important to point out, but I think a lot of people in America who don't really follow this issue, they kind of just tune in when something like this happens, who aren't aware that, Hamas was elected. And the reason why Hamas was chosen over Fatah in Gaza specifically was that Gazans saw Fatah as being financially corrupt, that they were a lot of the aid money coming in was being kind of embezzled and being, kept for those at the top. And so Gazans were sick of it. And so they saw Hamas as another option. Unfortunately, Hamas, though, has never held another election since. And they don't really, democracy has failed in Gaza. So, yes, they were elected, but, they're not looking to leave anytime soon. I don't know if I have an answer to your question, what was going through their mind. Obviously, I'm not a member of Hamas, nor do I agree with what they did. But I have to think that when a people, a marginalized people, are left in a state of despair for as long as, let's say, you know, the Gazans have been in this open-air prison, right? That, you know, I try to remind people when people hear the Gaza Strip, I don't even know if they know what the size of the land is. It's, you know, it's less than half the size of Marion County, and it has 2.2 to 2.5 million people, depending on the census, living in this space, right? So this is one of the most densely populated areas on planet Earth, and where they have no control over, like you said, resources. And I think that's, for me, it was one of my biggest lessons I had to learn when I was there in 2005, because I had just come out of this master's program specifically looking at kind of the religious implications of this conflict. And I was there on the ground, and I was really learning how much kind of I didn't know what I didn't know. You know what I mean? And what I realized was this is really a political conflict. This is about control of resources. This is about control of land and water. Yeah. And the way I saw it, and the way I look at it more so now, is that religion has been hijacked on all sides as a way of drawing a line in the sand and determining which side of the conflict you will support. And to me, this is really about land and water. And you can see that in the West Bank. You can see that in Gaza, where you have the wall. And if you were able to fly a drone up and look down at both simultaneously, you would see arid, dry, like you said, there's only water cisterns on the roofs of these buildings because many people, the only way they have access to water is what they can collect during the rainy season because Israel shut the water off. And then directly opposite of the wall, you will have lush green golf courses with fountains flowing with water, right? So it's not as if this is an arid region where no one has water. It's being shut off. And so when you have a people who have been...
Can you give us a little bit more details? The side of the wall with the luscious green, that's the Israeli side.
That's correct. Yes. I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah. So the Israeli side, they'll have these lush, green, lavish estates, and they'll have these, you know, sometimes country clubs, like literally going right up against the wall. And then directly opposite, you'll have these in you know, really, really economically devastated areas where they have no control over the resources. And they'll have the, you know, electricity turn off at with no notice. They'll have water turned off at no notice, no access to health care. They have no freedom of movement to go to a hospital. Sometimes the ambulances are bombed, you know. So, it's just I think about is when you ask the question, what was going through Hamas's mind? I think they must have known, obviously, there was going to be collective punishment. I think it's too simple to say that they have no regard for their fellow Gazans. I think it was probably a calculated decision, and I think what it was to collect as many hostages as possible. When you think about what happened, what was it, a couple years ago when Hamas had kidnapped one Israeli soldier, and they were able to trade for that one Israeli soldier, I think it was 11,000 Palestinian political prisoners, okay?
Yeah.
So you see the complete imbalance of human life from the Israeli perspective, that they value this many Palestinians for one Israeli life. I think what their goal was, get as many hostages as possible to try to trade for the 11,000 Palestinian political prisoners, including women and children who have been held without trial, right, for years. So I think it was a calculated decision. I think they knew there was going to be retaliation. I suspect they even were thinking that if it was bad enough that the international community, I don't mean the West, but some of the other Arab states and other countries that support their situation would intervene. I don't know. I think for them it's a risk worth taking in order to achieve something. I don't agree with their stance. I don't agree that for them the only solution is the destruction of Israel and destruction of the Jewish people. I think that's a horrific mission statement. But, you know, I think it's when diplomacy fails and you leave people in that state of despair for that long, this is where we end up, unfortunately.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Marianne, what do you think was going through Hamas's mind? Well, they knew the retribution was going to be quite severe.
First of all, do we know that Hamas did it? I mean, did they come out and say that, take responsibility? Because I haven't heard
okay.
that.
Okay, fair question. Fair question. Fair question.
So I don't know.
Yeah, we have been told.
I don't know who did it, but it's appalling whoever did it. And I feel
fair question.
I sympathize with all the grieving families in Israel as well as what's going on in Gaza, because it's collective punishment, which is against international law. And how can you, I mean, it's massacre. You're massacring the people. If they can't have food and water and medicine, especially food and water, 3 days without water and a person will die. And maybe a week without food and the person will die. I mean, really, how can anyone with any conscience allow that to happen? And Biden, who's lost his son, should especially be aware of the grief of losing family members.
Yes.
I mean, I just am appalled at our own reaction as well. I mean, the bias has always been there, but my God, you don't kill everyone just because proof you don't know how it started, you didn't investigate, you just assumed that whatever was said is true, and maybe it is, but those people deserve to be considered, I mean, civilians just should not be, blanket collective punishment.
Yes.
That's against the law.
Well,
of course, it doesn't matter. We've been broken so many international law that, nobody's going to care, apparently. But there's got to be some compassion for these people.
Yes.
Many of these people don't know what Hamas does. They have no control over anybody. They're just trying to live their lives and survive. So suddenly you're adding elements. And I really think the Israelis want Gaza, frankly. There's gas off the shore. They're probably going to turn it into some kind of resort or whatever if they if they do some ethnic cleansing and get rid of them. That's what I see. And I'm sorry to say that. I hope I'm wrong, but I don't see that. I see that they're going to just the right wing in government right now probably don't care about anything but getting their way. So. Mm-hmm. People on either side get killed, they don't care because they want to have their goals, reach their goals.
Yeah, okay, let me get a couple of callers. But I do want to make one observation. Because you raised a good question. Hamas has not claimed credit, but they will sit back the question for as dense as Gaza is and it's as difficult as it is to get in and to get out. It would seem to be it originated from someone who was living already or established already in Gaza, and that even though Hamas has not said taking credit for it, it's hard to explain how you get that many fighters or soldiers into an area that can penetrate the walls or kill 1,000 people. If Hamas didn't do it, then they should be saying something as well. So that's a conversation for later on. And from a religious perspective, if the Jewish law says, if it is a religious response, even the worst they say an eye for an eye, but they say 10 eyes for one eye. There's no, even following their law, the revenge often is quite severe. I have a caller here that's
a portion to the crime. They don't follow the law, so they're above the law and they don't follow the law. So their responses are always out of proportion to what's happened. And because they're responsible for these people, they don't had they taken care of them according to international law, there wouldn't be this grievance.
That's true.
But they don't. Don't respect them. And the irony is, Palestinians never caused any trouble to Jewish people historically. They lived together. The Palestinians were the ancient Canaanites. They've always been in that land.
So there, historically, one can't say I was there before the other. They were both there. So it's
yeah.
It's just that there was the kingdom of Judea and Samaria for less than a century, 90 years. That was all it was before it was conquered and they were conquered. So it's really tragic that they're using religions for in the political arena. It should not. There's no place for
yeah.
a religion in politics. But
yeah,
Biden labels
yeah.
himself a Christian Zionist, and others resent, you know,
scary.
You know, a Jewish
scary.
Zionist or whatever.
Yeah.
But you know, if we treated people with respect, there wouldn't be fear for anybody, any minority or any majority even. I mean,
yes,
nobody
ma'am.
Should be
yes,
afraid
ma'am.
Because they're a Jewish or Muslim or Christian or Asian or black or whatever it is. I mean, this country is a melting pot, and we've in the past have you know done so much, contributed so much to our societies, and now I feel like we're withholding from the public. You know, we're just not providing services that we used to provide. We're not, you know, we're not taking care of employees the way we used to. The CEOs have these monumental salaries. I mean, the malaise
yes.
in the society is covering every area of society.
Yes,
I mean, children are
yes,
affected. There's violence in the schools. There's anger in the right-wing groups. I understand the anger. I really do. On all sides, I understand it, but it does not serve anyone. It has to
correct.
Be addressed in a way that we can solve the problems. And that
yes,
takes time and diplomacy. And that's always a slower process, but it results in wonderful things in the end. I mean, you know, just look at what was created in the early 20th century. So I'm in this country. We achieved so much and provided so much. We had wonderful schools, wonderful societies. I mean, people were, in general, content. We could survive on one salary. Those were the good old days, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes, ma'am.
And
okay.
children were protected. So anyway,
no,
the problem
yes,
is
I just have some problems. So hold on, I need to get to.
I should go. I just want to thank you for having me, and I pray that all
oh, thank you.
Ends well. And I thank you for inviting me. And Lee, thank you for your comments.
You
really
are the welcome.
Thank you. It was
Dr.
a pleasure
Marianne.
To have a conversation.
Yes. Lee, she had her time. We have a few more calls. She had time to hold on.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Great. Okay, great. Don't go to, this is my sister, Hydra. She had her hand up and down. I'm going to take her to what my sister got to say. Sister Hydra, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. Just thank you so much for this program. What the sister was saying, I am so fully in agreement with it, and it was so pleasant to hear someone speaking with such balance and understanding. I just wanted to mention Imam Muhammad's definition of diplomacy. I recall his definition being diplomacy is negotiating for better behavior. And I thought that was such a great definition. And I just pray Allah that some people can come to the table using diplomacy, sincere diplomacy. Thank you, Brother Nikhil. Beautiful program.
Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you very much. My sister is here from New Jersey. Okay, we have a few more callers there. And I thank you all for your patience. I'm trying to get everybody in, and if I can. Okay, we're going to go from the East Coast to the West Coast. It's our brother Amin from L.A. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Amin.
Walaikum assalam. Can you hear me?
Kinda,
yeah.
You're a little bit faint. You must be on, well, wait a minute, are you on speakerphone or Bluetooth? Because you sound faint.
A little faint, huh? Okay.
Yeah.
Let's see if I can get the phone in my ear. Hold on here.
Yeah, you come to the phone directly.
Yeah, okay, maybe this is might be a little better.
Yes,
alhamdulillah. you know, we ask Allah to you know, bless the ones who lost their lives. But my question is, how did the Israelis not know that this was happening? This was, I mean, this is supposed to be, I mean, they say this is supposed to be the largest open-air prison in the world, but a concentration of 2.5 million people, 2.5 million people. And the sister said earlier, approximately $153 billion have went into Israel. How did they not know? I mean, in this regard, I'm a conspiracy theorist. It's kind of like 9-1-1. People say that someone knew that was going to happen, and when it did happen, it was an excuse for the West to go in and take over Libya and Syria and golly, all the Middle East oil producing countries. And they're threatening Iran just because of that one event. And I just can't figure out what, I mean, who benefits from this. I mean, I know I'm thinking Israel is benefiting from this, but what it is, what are they trying to do? What are they after? You know what I mean? Because there's nowhere in the world they shouldn't have known.
Yeah, but let's can get at least, I want to see if I guess Leif, if he has any thoughts on that. Many people ask the question, Israel don't have one of the best security systems in the world. It's got the Iron Dome. They have some of the world's top intelligence and all that. How did this happen?
Right. So that's an excellent question. And I just quickly want to – also the first caller talked about diplomacy. I just want to quickly say something about that as well before I answer the question about what – you know, how did Israel let this happen, right?
Sure.
Absolutely agree with diplomacy is absolutely necessary. I think what I learned in my training in conflict resolution is that whoever the mediator is, they can't have a stake in the outcome, right? So in my opinion, America can no longer serve as a mediator between the Palestinians and the Israelis because America clearly has a stake in the outcome, right? So that's one side of it. And the other is, you know, what the report that came out, the leaked memo from the United States State Department this week, where they said to all their diplomats they were discouraging them from using any language of de-escalation, ceasefire, restoring calm, end violence, bloodshed. So it's from up on top, there's been – it's the diplomacy side of it from America's perspective is let this play out, let the war happen, right? And then to the second caller's question, which, again, is a great, great question, I don't know – from a conspiracy side, obviously we don't know, right? We don't know, but there are reports that Egypt let Israel know 3 days prior that Hamas was planning something big, okay? So that is a report that is circulating. Now, the legitimacy of that, I can't speak to that. So I don't want to just spread, you know, misinformation, but that there is a report that Egypt did let Israel know. And so I think the second part of that question is, what do they get out of this, right? What's the goal, right? I think there's a couple things we can look at that could be possible explanations as to what the goal could be in the situation. Why would Israel allow this to happen if they did, in fact, sort of turn a blind eye to or allow the attack to occur? I know that, you know, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been kind of in some controversies of his own in Israel proper, where you know, they're seeking to delegitimize the democracy of Israel by giving the Supreme Court supreme power. You know, there's been a lot of massive protests in Israel of Israelis calling for his resignation. So it could be a deflect kind of thing if we can keep. We can allow the population to kind of come together against a unified enemy of Hamas. Maybe they'll forget about my misgivings and all my, you know, corruption. I don't know. But I think there's a lot of things going on the ground that we don't necessarily think about or know much about.
It sounds like you're giving like the wag the dog kind of scenario.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
And if you just follow this audience, that's a movie, Wag the Dog. It says most times
the
dog wags the tail, but they flip the script, the tail is wagging the dog. And it is a ploy used to, if you're in hot water to divert attention from you, you would create a bigger havoc. And so that's, I just wanted to get to make that point, clarify that point. But that's a good question that needs to be answered. And I'm very much interested to see what the Israeli government or people are going to say over the next year or two as to what caused that breach.
Right.
In the Israeli army of security, because that's a very good question. Thank you, Brother Amin Muhammad, for the excellent question. Okay, we're going to go on up the line. We've got a couple more callers I want to get to. I had this already. Call from 914. Call 914-434. Thanks for calling Worth Name People. Can you give us your first name and your city, please?
Yes, this is Muhammad calling from Mount Vernon, New York.
This is Muhammad from Mount Vernon. Go ahead, please.
Well, I guess basically my room is not going.
You listen to, and there's a couple that I mentioned that may not be very common. One is Al Jazeera. You can go to aljazeera.com and get another perspective. I'm not saying they're saying it all truth. I'm just saying diversify who you listen to. Another one is quite good that I personally recommend would be Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. She seems to give a perspective. And quite interesting, I'm surprised, if I'm not mistaken, I think she's Jewish, but she's quite balanced, in my opinion. Lizzie, what are some outlets that you can share with our listeners so they can tune into telephone or internet that can give different opinions on this same conversation? Do you have any recommendations?
Well, yes, I mean, it's interesting you said Democracy Now! Because that when I was saying earlier I was waiting all weekend for Monday, that was who I was waiting for, was for Amy Goodman. They are – the work that they do is phenomenal. They also – and there's another organization, Intercept, with Jeremy Scahill. And Jeremy actually is close colleagues with Amy. They all kind of come from the same school of journalism. He's done a lot of work looking at there's a wonderful documentary that he did. I'm trying to remember the name. I think it's Jeremy Scahill.
What's his last name again?
Scahill, S-C-A-H-I-L-L. And he did a documentary called Dirty Wars. That's what it's called, Dirty Wars. And but he also runs this news organization called The Intercept, and they have a podcast that goes along with it called Intercepted. And they produce just wonderful independent journalism. I would also suggest, Mother Jones, as they are still producing, I think it's 6 physical issues every year. They're really, really strong journalism. There's others. I think you just, again, really just do – I would encourage listeners to do their due diligence and really understand I really like the Young Turks, but I do know, obviously, they have a slant, more of a progressive slant.
I'm sorry, the last one that you broke up, you said I really like, and then you broke up.
Oh, I really like the Young Turks. So another progressive news organization. Obviously, they have a bias, but as a progressive, I really appreciate what they share. I think Democracy Now! is one of my primary ones. I do like Al Jazeera a lot. Unfortunately, some of the other sources I would trust in the past, I kind of use. Where I let what happens with Palestine Israel kind of serve as a litmus test for how balanced they're going to be, and a lot of the ones in the past that I would have looked to really just fail miserably, at balance when it comes to this issue. And they're also mm-hmm. they're quick to, when America gets involved in any sort of military operation of any kind, even if it's just like as a proxy war situation like in Ukraine, they're very, very pro-war, and that really troubles me. I always wonder, like, you know, what the shareholders and things like that, like, you know, again, who the ultimate question is always who benefits, right? Who seeks to profit off of the X, Y, or Z? And so, yeah, I look mm-hmm. for those mm-hmm. news agencies that are only making money off of memberships. They're not getting, you know, donations from big donors and stuff like that.
And that's very key. If they get support from big donors, they are not going to disappoint their supporters. Those who advertise with them, they will not
exactly.
have anything to do their bankroll. Have called, I think, Sister Satana again. I think she had another comment, if I'm mistaken. Sister Satana, can you give a follow-up comment?
I sound like you have other callers. If you do, you need to leave me for last.
Huh?
I said if you have other callers, you can leave me for last.
Leave you for last? Why doesn't? Because we have to keep moving.
You have other people that you want. I want to hear their comments. Do you have other people?
Now, no, not right now. But we have some more material to cover, so I can give you a limited amount of time. Go ahead, please.
Okay. All right. The sister said that we are melting pot. We were moving towards being a tossed salad. All right. In this country, okay? The Israelis already was doing things before Hamas took this October 7th thing. They were already doing things. So, yeah. Okay, the next thing is I want to know, all of our tax money is going over there to Israel. They keep spending billions of dollars. And yet, what kind of security? Where did the money go? Because if you have a good security, you shouldn't have had that. All right. The other thing is that when we look at the small blankets that were given to our brothers here in America, it's like the same thing as giving no water to the Palestinians. It's a complete extermination.
Yes, ma'am. Those are the concerns that have been on the agenda. And these, you know, some of this reminds me of gentrification that we complain of here in America, where a new set of people come in to take over what's been long held by one set of people. And there's not much justice. We know the original meaning of gentrification is positive, but its application has been quite disruptive for long-time residents. And I think there's something similar going on here. I kind of heard our sister, Sutana, just now allude to that. Somebody else alluded to it earlier. I think Mary Ann did. What are the plans after the invasion of Gaza? And they say eradication of Hamas. What are the plans? Because first, and also further described on the west edge, as you take Gaza, it's a long narrow strip, but on the western edge, it's all water.
Right.
And that's about 26 miles long. Of
like 25,
of water. And all that's important. Now, water means a lot of things, you know, import, export, et cetera.
Right. So,
go ahead.
They do have, you know, the whole western edge of the Gaza Strip is the coastline, but they Gazans only have they can only be in, I think, within a mile to 2 miles of the coastline. If they go beyond that, they are bombed out of the water. So fishing is non-existent, which was a big part of their economy. The blockade on Gaza is not just the wall, but it's also the sea and obviously the air. So yeah, it's you have the ocean, but the ability to not access its resources is almost, it's like being able, it's like being in a desert and looking at, you know, and finding like a mirage, right? It's a mirage of health. It's a mirage, but it's, that's not really there. It's like, here's the ocean, but what can they do with it really, as far as like saving their lives? Yeah. So
wait,
you know,
you said something. Wait, I've got to pause you for a second, please. You said,
sure,
something I didn't know. It's shocking what you just said. That 26 roughly mile stretch of coastline, you're saying that if the Palestinians use that, they would be bombed?
Right.
Uh-huh.
So they could only be in boats within 1 to 2 miles of the shoreline. And if they go beyond that, the Israeli Navy will blow the ships out of the water. So they have no access to fishing, because with the fishing does not really, it's so shallow, where those 1 to 2 miles, so it's really unusable for any sort of sustenance.
So the question, not that we can answer here, but just for the consciousness of the world, how can the world stand by and see the Palestinians in a, and when you say prison, it's an open-air prison. They have prison walls around it. But on the water side, they would be bombed if they go out more than a mile or two from the coastline. How can Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Syria, the USA, America, how can they sit by quietly knowing there's 2.2 million people pent up in their situation and they can't even control gas, light, water, food supply? How can they, with a conscience, say, you got 24 hours to leave? You know, and just a little side note here, so we're going to wrap up here. Remember Katrina, and a guy at work, asked me, wait a minute, a guy at work, he asked me, he said, well, how come they just didn't leave? You know, like, okay,
right.
Poor people just don't have the option. Sometimes they have a hard time getting across town, getting to work. So then let's fast forward to Rita. When Rita hit Houston and everyone did try and leave, right? Houston got about 2 million people, and everyone did try and leave. What happened? The people got on the highway, ran out of gas, ran out of medicine. Some people died on the highway. And these are people who have resources trying to leave Houston from Hurricane Rita. How can the world sit by quietly and talk about, well, you know, they shouldn't have done that? People here have been poor for how long have they been in blockade?
Well, 16 years under the most recent blockade.
Yeah.
But the caller was right that even before Hamas won the election in 2006, like I was there in 2005, the week that Israel was disengaging the settlements, they were removing the settlements from Gaza. The conditions were just as bad then. So this goes on beyond, goes way back further and further and further. I think just the last 16 years under the most recent blockade, things have become more concentrated. But to address the question of how can the world look on and watch, I think that's the million-dollar question, right? The only thing I will say, though, is sort of as a caution first before I kind of give my response is, When I see the news of all these massive protests in the Arab world, right, look and seeing the protests in Egypt or the protests in Jordan, literally up to the border of Israel, look what's going on in Lebanon, and you see even, you know, obviously Saudi Arabia's involvement in their cooperation with Israel right now. There's it's a complex thing, but historically, going all the way back to 1948, when the Arab world has gotten involved, meaning going to war with Israel, and the same thing in 67. In my opinion and in my research, the Arab world wasn't fighting on behalf of Palestinians. They were fighting against Israel. And so when they lost and were pushed back, who paid the price? Palestinians did. The war was fought in their yards, but they didn't ask for this, right? And so I get nervous when I see the neighboring states sort of start to like react this way, because I think, again, it's people start to get itchy and they want to fight Israel, And who's going to pay the price for this, though, when it doesn't work out? And that is the Palestinians. So I get nervous about that. But as far as, like, how does...
Leif,
yeah.
I'm sorry. You made a point. I want you to go a little further if you can, because we need to understand this situation, the complexity. You made a very good point. I think you said, you may have said Saudi Arabia. When they went to war against Israel, they were not really fighting on behalf of the Palestinians. They were, their main focus was against Israel. But
right.
For the Palestinians, for many Muslim countries, let's tell the truth. We talk about telling the truth here. Palestinians have been a pawn.
Exactly.
By many Muslim countries. We need to bring that out, too, because it's not going to solve it, I know, but at least let's bring some clarity to our listeners. Can you go a little bit further on that? So there's other countries besides Saudi Arabia who attacked Israel, but they didn't get 2 cents. They didn't have a concern with Palestinians as they may pretend to have.
Right, and I think they often use them as sort of the, they kind of cash in on the plight of the Palestinians for their own kind of political situation to rally support in their countries. And they can, you know, look like they support the Palestinians. They can have these rallies and protests, but really nothing comes of it. No aid, no attempts at diplomacy, you know, trying to bring Israel to the negotiating table that aren't met with, you know, and again, without their sort of belief, the only solution is that Israel's gone. Like, well, that's a non-starter, right? So I don't know. I really struggle with that. But I think the bigger question you were asking, and I think it's important we address it before we end today, is, you know, how does the West specifically, how do we look on? I think if we're telling the truth, and this is painful. This is painful to say this, I think it'd be ignorant to not acknowledge that we're talking about brown people and we're talking about Muslims specifically. And in the West, we don't have a good track record with how we interact with people of color and how we interact with people of faith differing than traditional, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. And so I think that if you look at why then is America, why do people on the left so support our support of Ukraine when they won't support what's going on with Palestine? And I don't know. I think it's really hard to not look at the fact that Ukrainians are basically a version of European. And for a lot of Americans, in their mind, they look like me, right? There's that sort of, I can relate to that because they look like me. Whereas they look at what happens with Palestinians, like, well, they don't look like me. They don't speak like me. They don't worship like I do, right? So in their mind, I'm not saying this is right. I'm trying to understand it myself is, well, if you don't look like I do, you don't worship like I do, and you don't speak like I do, and you dress differently than I do, then we have nothing in common. Why should I care about your plight? But also you're asking why do people in the West – why do they not care about their even Palestinian Christian neighbors, right? So we have the Palestinian Christian community who now make up less than 1% of the population in Palestine, Israel. But, you know, so why don't Christians in the West care about their situation? And, you know, I think we have to look at the fact that America in general are we're a very isolationist kind of society. When we don't know the name of our own next-door neighbor, typically, most Americans don't, why would we expect them to care about then someone literally on the other side of the world who, even if they pray like they do, they still don't look like I do, they still don't speak like I do, right? So I don't know. I think there's a lot of answers to the question, but I think we have to look at that.
Yes, yes, okay. I have a call here, been quite patient. I think I overlooked them. I think call from 347. You don't worry, man. People, can you give us your first name and city, please?
Yes, it's Steve Mohassen, and I'm from the New York area, and I'm very grateful. Let me say before I ask my question and make my comment, kudos go, great graciousness goes to the CEO of AM360, Sister Latifa, who I called on that simulcast number, but didn't realize that you couldn't see my hand when I pushed 1 to come in and make a comment.
Yes,
she was so kind as to call me and ask me to call in on your direct number so my hand could be seen. So I really love her.
Yeah, thank you, because you are reminding me of an announcement I'm supposed to have made from the beginning. Yes, today we're working in conjunction with AM 360. We are on station IWDM, and we are teaming up with our brothers and sisters from station AM 360. And so we are simulcasting today, and we are glad to welcome everyone for AM 360 for being with us. And we thank Sister Latifa Hameen for her dedication to bring us closer and closer together.
Thank you for
reminding me to make that announcement. Go ahead with your comment.
Imam Sahir. And I want to thank you for this phenomenal program. I am executive producer and former host on AM 360. So we share the same commitment to information, knowledge, and this dispelling of ignorance, which one of your guests just mentioned as a huge drawback in the information that we share and we are access to from media, and therefore we don't have, through the problems in media, a comprehensive concept of the truth as it actually exists. And often our perceptions are colored by the amount of false information that can be distributed through the news media. I'm not faulting the news media as a whole, but there are strategic efforts, we're aware, being made to misguide and misinform. Your guests have been wonderful. I'm going to extend what I'm saying because I waited so long. But anyway, your guests have been tremendously informing our community and our listeners. And I was in tears most of the time that I don't know her name, your female guest, because of the high criteria of rationale and logic that she applied to understand what was really, to broaden our understanding and perception of the reality of what's really going on. And the other guests that you have, both of them, have been extremely enlightening to us, waking us up that there may be something going on we simply don't have the awareness of.
Make a fair point. It's a fair point. It just dawned on me that my guest today was one was a Muslim, one was a Christian, one was a Jew. It just dawned on me. But it came from following good advice of Imam Muhammad, and he told us to get involved with the interfaith community. And, you know, in the Quran tells us, you know, go talk to those different religions. You know, if you have a question about what the Quran says, the Quran says, go talk to the people of the book, as far as theirs. And so I'm not taking credit. I'm humble and I thank you. But it came from us being obedient to join the goals of like mine.
And we're obligated, like one of the things that strengthened my faith in Al-Islam is the Imam emphasizing how self-obligated we are to exercise, function, think, and practice the principles of Al-Islam, our standards of living. So when we seek to do that, Allah opens a way to enlighten us and guide us to the best. So I do a ton of religious, comparative religion. In fact, I had been invited, and I do conduct a class at the senior facility where I live on Quranic studies. And the administration invited me to do that. And I have to say, I'm the only practicing Muslim in this facility, right? But there was so much interest just by the social relationships that I have built and the population, the residents have, you know, we interact with each other, we speak,
yes,
we treat each other like neighbors, and it expanded their curiosity. Well, Mahasin, what is your life?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. You know, so I encourage all of us, regardless of the religious choosing that we have, to interact with each other based upon our consummate faith in one Creator, one God. And last question, very important. How should we access a replay of this wonderful program if we want to review it and have it grant us power and understand?
Great. A good question. If you have the link that I sent out, the link would be connected forever with this program. And most times when you send the phone number out, we put the link along with it, because you can come back next week, next year even, and give that link a click. It will take you to this program. A second way to find this program, if you're on Facebook, go to my Facebook page. Michael McKelsey here, that's the name of my Facebook page. And you can just kind of, you have to go, and you can do a search on my page and put in this topic, the topic being the Israeli-Palestine saga of innocent blood on guilty hands. You can find it. A third way, just go to Google and type in Words Made People, Michael Sahir, and put in Israeli-Pakistan, Palestine, the Israeli-Palestine saga, and you should be able to find it with a Google search. So those are three ways that, and the fourth way, just give me a call, and I have to find it as well.
And do you have a direct number?
Everybody knows anyway, so I don't mind telling it to the world. My number is 317-753.
Mm-hmm.
3754. Again, 317-753-3754. And
thank
if I don't
you.
Answer, I'm probably busy. Just leave me a message or a text. So.
Okay. And last thing that I want to say, and this is so we can, you know, Allah says when we are grateful, He will give us more. That's a Quranic principle. I'm going to suggest, as a part of the strategic planning area of AM360, that we develop a prize-winning concept where we can recognize and reward programs of this caliber. You know, like they have different prizes in the area of media and literature excellence, you have consistently established a high caliber of information sharing with our audiences.
Thank you very much.
And we want to honor and commend you. Ameen. All right, I'm out.
Thank you very much. Okay, sister. Mahasin from New York. I guess if you mind, this is October marks our 11th year. I mean, this is our anniversary month, October. Okay. Thank you, sister Mahasin. Lise, we did not talk about the map. In 1946, the map was called Palestine, of this particular country. In 1947, with the UN partition, you know, the British mandate and all that, give the Jewish community a homeland. A little bit more than half, about half of the country was given to Israel and a half to Palestinians. Due to other conflicts, wars, settlements, Jewish settlements taking Palestinian land, is almost the entire country is the Jewish state, and very little is left for the Palestinian people.
Right.
Do you have any comments over this 46 by 75 year change?
I mean, I would encourage viewers to try to find maps that really show, like you just brought up, the kind of a timeline of what, Yeah, when you look at that, you can really see the shrinking, right? The Palestinian side, shrinking. Often, depending on the source, you know, the most current will still show kind of like the 1967 border for Palestine. It looks kind of like a kidney bean. Unfortunately, though, that's not accurate because, as you brought up, the settlement. So it's what's happening right now in the West Bank specifically is you have these illegal, and I say illegal not because I just don't like them, but because even in the international community and in the United Nations, they are deemed illegal. You have these settlements that are popping up, and what they'll do is they're annexing more and more parts of the West Bank. So that wall that we've all talked about today, it keeps getting moved further and further and further in towards, you know, kind of claiming more and more land. Or what they'll do is they'll build these settlements, and then they'll build a road that is has walls around it that only settlers can access. And so the land keeps getting divided and cut up. And even like Marianne brought up, farmers who's, you know, they're the very crops they depend upon for their livelihood, that's on the other side of the wall. And usually what happens is they're only allowed access maybe once a week on a certain time. And then they'll show up and a lot of their trees have been uprooted or burned, you know, some sort of retaliation, things like that. So, yeah, the map is shrinking. The question always comes up is...
When you say the map is shrinking for who?
For the Palestinians, right. So their side is shrinking dramatically because even if that border still shows up on a map as the 1967 border or even the border that was, you know, brought up in the 93 Oslo Accords, the settlements are claiming more of that land and cutting that land up of the West Bank. So the Palestinians' land is being cut up to where they can't access, even to travel around within the West Bank. You're stopped at so many checkpoints, sometimes moving checkpoints that are just, you come down a road and there's an Israeli military vehicle with a couple concrete cinder block or a big concrete blocks there they use as a barrier, and they've, you know, machine gun nest, things like that, and you have to wait in line. I mean, I was stuck at the Abu Holi checkpoint in Gaza for 27 hours, and that is the main checkpoint that separates the north from the south, and we had gone down to the southern part of Gaza to Rafah, which at that time was the most devastated area, which is right next to the Egyptian border. We had gone down to do work, and we took a tour of the an orphanage, and that's when we were fired upon by the Israeli snipers. There's these sniper towers all throughout the Gaza Strip, and when I say that, they're not just around the wall, but they are situated throughout the Gaza Strip to where there's not a single square inch of the Gaza Strip that those towers can't see. And so we were touring the orphanage. It's run by a Catholic NGO called SOS. And they did not like us being there, so they were firing into the compound. We were, you know, basically having to, you know, get cover and then get to, you know, so we were down there, and we tried to return to Gaza City to our headquarters, and the Abu Holi checkpoint was closed. And we were told at that time, oh, yeah, sometimes it closes for 9 months. I'm like, wait, what? we have to get to the north. And so we ended up, our vehicle did have documentation as being part of Norwegian People's Aid, but we were off to the side with two UN vehicles who were there to kind of document the disengagement of the settlements that week, where they were always there, but they were specifically on that mission. And then two Doctors Without Borders vehicles were there as well for the same reasons. And we were kind of off to the side. Meanwhile, you know, tens and thousands of Palestinians on the south side of the checkpoint needed to get to the north, and vice versa, people in the north needed to get south. And we were there all day into the night, and we knew that it was not safe for us to be there, so we actually sort of retreated back to Khan Yunis, where we stayed at a hostel for the evening, and then the morning came back and kind of resumed our place in line waiting, and had, you know, I had to make some strategic calls to the military commander at the checkpoint in order to kind of negotiate an opening of the checkpoint and use some interesting tactics to make that happen. And, yeah, 15 minutes later, it was open. But it was closed for 27 hours then. And that's nothing compared to what they deal with all the time. So, you know, it's the whole – when everything's shrinking and the checkpoints are there to kind of enforce this sort of, you know, police state all the time. There's no free movement. There's no access to resources. Like, when we think about the ability to go – to see a friend for lunch, and it's, if you look on the map and GPS tells you, oh, it's a 15 miles away, and it's going to take you in traffic about 25 minutes. Well, that 15-mile drive in the West Bank could take you 6 hours, depending on, you know, which way you go. It's just, so you never know, right? And so I think there's a lot of things we take for granted. Ease of movement is one of them. And obviously access to resources is another.
Yes, sir. Well, I hope we can, and this is just one program, and they have a listening audience and a following, but it's nowhere near big, we're close to the big media outlets, but maybe some of our voice from today may reach those who can make decisions on both sides. We do have an issue on both sides of the table, and let's just admit that. The leadership on both sides should do a lot better. And that includes our leadership here in the USA of America. My homeland, I'm born and raised here. I love the country, but we have to do better. There's too much rhetoric on both sides. And quit only criticizing the opinion side and always praising closing the eye to the wrong of the Israeli side. That is not going to solve the problem. I also have shared this here with some of my interfaith friends, including rabbis that were there. If you surround, if they have already done, and invade and demolish, as they say they're going to do, Gaza, you're only going to create more terrorists. That's all you're going to do. You're not going to, if you don't change the thinking, the ideologies, the message that's in people's heads, you are not going to solve the problem. I compared it, Leif. I compared them. I said going into Gaza is like going to the ocean and trying to get rid of starfish. You may recall they had an incident someplace in history. They were tired of all the starfish, so they cut them up and threw them back in the water. And if you know starfish, even though they cut up, they will reproduce themselves. So you think you're getting rid.
Assalamu alaikum. I'm so sorry to cut that off, but our program here is going to cut off in about 5 minutes. So I just wanted to, I didn't want to just go off, but you can dial 714-816-4673. 714-816-4673. If you'd like to continue listening to IWDM, Words Make People with Imam Sahir. He's on every Sunday from 1 to 3 Eastern Standard Time on IWDM. And again, the phone number is 714-816-4673. We will broadcast every third Sunday with IWDM in conjunction with AM360. So thank you so much for joining in. We appreciate you so much. May Allah continue to bless us as we work in this journey to remake this world into a better place. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And enjoy the rest of your evening.